You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Greetings, scholar warriors and fellow travelers. This is CJ, your Renaissance man in this new, dark and ever-darkening age in which we find ourselves. Back with another dose of dangerous history. Yes, I know my episode frequency has been pretty bad the last few months, but I'm hoping to turn that around starting this month. As I've gotten fairly settled into my new home, still working on my home office though, I've got a lot still of unpacking and reorganization. Or should I say organization, to complete until it's finally finished, but it's at least at the point where it's pretty functional just day to day. Albeit a little bit unkempt in appearance. So in this episode, I'm presenting you with a conversation I had last weekend over the Zoom with good friend and fellow history podcaster Alexander Rader von Sternberg of the podcast History Impossible, which is one of the relatively few history podcasts that I actually listen to. Most of the many history podcasts out there are either too superficial, too boringly establishment, or just not very well done, or some combination thereof, and therefore I am quite a snob when it comes to history podcasts. But Alex's show History Impossible is one of the few on my shortlist that I actually do subscribe to in my podcatcher. Anyway, a few weeks back, Alex messaged me on social media and floated the idea of having a conversation to record in some fashion about the overall idea that the United States is going through some sort of major realignment that's bigger and more encompassing than just a simple change of political party system or something like that. So I took him up on the offer, and this conversation, which runs, I think, around 2 hours and 45 minutes, is the result. And so I present it for your listening pleasure. We go all over the place and pretty deep, talking about historical parallels, talking about possible ways this could play out, and really trying to dig deep and get at the root of things and not stay, you know, trapped on the surface where most people's discourse and understanding remains. And I always enjoy talking with Alex. He is my favorite kind of person to have a conversation with, whether on or off the record. And what I mean by that is I most enjoy and feel I get the most benefit out of talking to someone whose overall ideas and ideology and perspective and worldview and so forth are like a Venn diagram of mine, where there's a fair amount of overlap, but there's also some important divergences. That way you get that baby bear's porridge just right. You know, because if you're just talking to somebody whose Venn diagram circle, like, completely overlaps with you, it can be kind of boring, because it's just sort of like each of you just constantly saying everything the other person said is brilliant without a whole lot of questions, comments, taking things in a different direction, whatever. It's like, you know, having a conversation with a clone. On the other hand, if you have a conversation with somebody who has no overlap with you on the Venn diagram of how you see the world and how you think about things, that is often extremely frustrating, because it's basically like the two of you are speaking different languages. It's like one of you's speaking Portuguese and the other is speaking Mandarin. And so to even start to find enough common ground to even have a coherent conversation is often very difficult. And if you've ever listened to the first time that Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris had a conversation, that to me is a good example where there's like so much divergence that it takes forever to get anywhere in terms of having any sort of meaningful back and forth. You know, if you're not even in fundamental agreement on basic definitions of terms and things like this. But anyway, I enjoyed the conversation very much, and I know you will too, and I would urge anybody who's not already a listener to History Impossible to go check it out, throw it in your podcatcher. You will enjoy it. And it gives you something else high quality to listen to in between DHP episodes. All right. So since you initially, sparked the idea for having this conversation, I wanted to get it rolling by asking you, what exactly you have in mind when you talk about that we're in a potential realignment sort of a phase in the United States? Like, what sorts of things specifically do you mean? Because I think this is something that can have potentially a lot of different aspects to it.
Right. I think when I think of realignment, I think of it as a sort of just sort of changing in what the core values. Well, it really is. Yeah, it's top down. It's like, or bottom up, really. It's core values up to specific policies. And I think that there is a shift in priorities in both major mainstream political camps that we currently have. And we can define those. We could probably just call it progressive versus conservative to keep it simple. There's probably a little more nuance in there that we can unpack, but I think that, yeah, it's a shift in values, and I see it as part of a historical American trend because we've gone through it several times. There's like a whole Wikipedia page on it, and there's a lot of debate on when these realignments happened. I think the thing that inspired me most is just all the conversations you and I have had, which, by the way, I think this is our fifth collaboration we've done. Technically, I've been on your show twice. You've been on my show once. And we did that Ripples of History with Daniele Bolelli. So, yeah, this is a record for me, I think. But it's from the conversations we've had and from what you've said, especially in your Woodrow Wilson series about you've used the term progressivism 4.0, 3.0, 2.0, 1.0, and that just has struck a chord with me that I think that the last realignment was the progressive realignment that we currently live in, and that was in approximately 1912, but it got going, before that by many decades. So it just struck me as like this sort of interesting pattern. And I sort of was just thinking, like, why does America feel so politically chaotic right now? Well, it was politically chaotic in the 19 teens. It was politically chaotic in the 19th century. And it was politically chaotic really since the beginning in a lot of ways. It just ebbs and flows. I just got done doing an episode about it was about a lot of things. It was about Savitri Devi, namely, but about the sort of worldview to which she subscribed and to which influenced at some level the Nazis, which is a cyclical view of history. And I, went out of my way to say, I don't buy cycles. I just don't think that that's how history works. Just like I don't think that history is a progression either. I think it's just a process of interactions. And it's funny that I said that because really what I'm describing right now is kind of a cycle. But I think that might be baked into something deeper in the American political DNA, possibly set out by the founding fathers. It just seems inevitable to me that we have long periods of political stability and then some kind of, well, usually it seems to me to be a populist backlash that arises for various reasons that then turns into a fundamental realignment of priorities and values within the two major camps.
Yeah. Okay. So that's sort of what I was expecting. Something like that, as far as what you're going to say, that this, you mean something that's deeper than merely like a shift of political party system it includes a political shift, but it goes far beyond that and includes cultural aspects. And as you were saying, values and like broadly ideology, not just party affiliation or one stance on certain particular issues, but like a more fundamental thing. Let me throw something out there. as I've been thinking about this in the last few days, you know, leading up to this conversation, I was thinking about, in my view, there's multiple kind of, for lack of a better term, pendulums or cycles happening simultaneously throughout American history. And they're not all on the same rhythm. But I think every now and then, a bunch of them will experience a change at roughly around the same time, and that perhaps that is what drives this more profound sort of realignment you're talking about today. So, you know, I was just sort of brainstorming and jotting down. So to me, the way I think about it, you've got some sort of a generational cycle happening. Like, I don't treat Strauss Howe, for example, in like a fundamentalist way where I take it as like the gospel truth, but I do think there's something to a lot of what they're saying, because
it's a good hypothesis. I mean, I was saying to Daryl Cooper actually on Twitter that I think it's a good starting point, just not a good concluding statement. And there's been attempts to try to, that's the problem I have though, is that with generational or cyclical theory is that all the people who write about it seem to be trying to confirm it rather than disconfirm it. Peter Turchin and I forget his first name, but Nefedov, their book Secular Cycles, that I've only started. I haven't finished it, so I can't speak to the whole thing, but they seem more intent on proving the hypothesis. And then you have like the billionaire Ray Dalio, who literally created an algorithm to try to prove it, but he was just basing it on credit cycles or something, which I think that's way too reductive for history. But anyway, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
So, you know, I think there is some sort of a generational rhythm, though. I think there's something to
right.
it. Then also one that we've spoken about before is the religious pendulum, where it seems like mm-hmm. in American history, there'll be a few generations in a row where there's an overall decrease in religiosity, and then there'll be a few generations in a row where there's an increase in religiosity, and that kind of swings back and forth. And, you know, each time there's an awakening period where there's an uptick in religiosity, it's a different kind of, there's a different flavor to it. You know, each awakening period has its own kind of theology and ideology and its own political implications. So, you know, as we've talked about before, if you look at the Great Awakening as just the latest, you know, distinctive Great Awakening, that, you know, ostensibly is not religious, but it doesn't take long of objective looking at.
I was going to say, yeah. It's literally the most religious thing that I've seen in the last like 10
yeah,
years.
Yeah. I mean, it's dogmatic, fundamentalist, and evangelical all at the same time. So anyway, that's the second sort of cycle I thought, you know, you can mm-hmm. sort of see working back and forth throughout American history. The third one is the shift of party system, which I've mm-hmm. talked about, you know, where you have the first party system and then it kind of breaks down and then a second party system emerges after it and so forth. And then another one that occurred to me, and probably, you know, if I thought about this long enough, I could come up with a bunch more. But the fourth one that occurred to me that's probably also happening is economic cycles. And here I don't mean like the boom bust cycle so much as I mean like different phases of, maybe for lack of a better term, different industrial revolutions. You know, so you have like the first industrial revolution, which is like the steam power, and a lot of it's actually light industry like textiles and things. And then you have the second industrial revolution, more kind of starting in the 1870s, where, you know, it's more about electricity and chemicals and heavier industry, like making giant
oil eventually.
Exactly, making yeah. giant things out of steel. Yeah, petroleum and chemicals and things start to be more of a factor. You know, and then you could, all these things you could kind of, you know, experts could disagree about exactly where the different lines are
sure.
between the different phases or whatever. But, you know, for sure, you could argue that the economic paradigm we've been in since maybe about the 1990s, right, where the internet emerges and becomes, you know, not just a major aspect of the economy, but now it's a major aspect of our social lives in just about every way. And, you know, are we,
and that's why
are we headed towards a fourth industrial revolution as the wonderful right. Klaus Schwab would tell us, right? And
what does he envision? I mean, I guess like I haven't, I mean, Klaus Schwab just, he literally looks like a supervillain, but he, and talks like one
yes.
too, but he, but what does he mean by what other industry is there? I mean, I recently saw the 1 millionth, and I do have my fingers crossed that this is true, but it's been said since like the 70s that nuclear fusion is almost here. I mean, is that what he's talking about, basically? Or is he going even further into the sci-fi realm and talking about things like antimatter? Like, what does he mean?
Yeah, I don't know. I have not read the Fourth Industrial Revolution. I've heard a few, like, you know, podcasters, alternative media types who I generally trust discuss it a little bit. Seems to me what a lot of it comes down to is kind of taking the next step for the internet, but also he seems to be really into this idea of like more bioengineering, that we're going to be doing things like modifying ourselves physiologically, you know, putting, like, literally he talks about putting chips in people and whatever.
Oh yeah. You know, Sweden already did it, right? Like with their, I don't know how much it, you know, took, but you know, there was, you know, a story about how they were putting in their vaccine passports in chip form under the skin. Like, I saw the footage of people doing it. It was like a news story on like every major, you know, news platform. And again, I don't know how well it took. I can't imagine it would take very well. I really can't imagine it ever taking off here in America. That just good luck with that if you want to try to implement that.
Yeah. Well, it seems like also a big part of it is the ability of both government and big corporations to more effectively, in kind of a sneaky way, be totalitarian. So if you heard the Joe Rogan episode recently with Majid Nawaz, where he explained a lot of this stuff.
I love Majid. I was worried that he had gone crazy, but he seems much more like stable than I expected, because he just was going like hard on his like LBC show back in the day. Shouldn't say back in the day, but it was back in the day. It was with COVID has warped my sense of time. It's been 2 years, but yeah, like he was going hard on that stuff and it was starting to sound unhinged. But when I actually heard him explain himself, I was relieved that, you know, I don't know if he's right, but at least he sounds like he has a stable sense of reality to a degree.
Yeah, and he did, you know, have the sources. He did have kind of the footnotes for everything he said. You know, he'd say something that sounds crazy, like, oh, they want to put chips on you to track you and decide what you're allowed to buy and whatever. And then he's like, yeah, and if you pull up this video, here's the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK literally saying it, you know. So it's these things that where, like, if Alex Jones says them, everyone just goes, oh, tinfoil hat. But then you actually go and like, no, these world leader types, these Klaus Schwabs and, you know, his people that are in governments around the world, whatever, like it's this bizarre thing where they flat out will say what they're up to. And yet if you go tell somebody on the street, hey, these world leaders want to track everything you do and decide whether or not you're allowed to buy a hamburger or whatever, they'd be like, oh, that's just insane. But like,
yeah,
they're telling you that's what they want to do.
Right. And I think the problem is that the only people who are like paying attention to this and who just have an opinion one way or the other are just, they don't like it. So when somebody comes at you with a negative like that, it's just going to motivate you to just be skeptical. The real dividing line here is that has yet to come, is what I'm saying, is not that is this a thing or is this happening? Because like you said, they are saying they want it to happen. So the question is going to turn into eventually, and I hope so, because, you know, that's a much more productive debate and you don't have to listen to people whinge about fake news or misinformation. It's just going to be a debate of, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? And I think that the unfortunate truth is that the only people talking about it right now are saying it's a bad thing. So that's going to incentivize people who don't trust them or don't like them for whatever particular reason to just suddenly say, in a reactionary sort of way, and this in a weird way kind of previews what an aspect of this conversation I was, you know, hoping to talk about, that they're just going to be reactionarily, if that's a word, positive on these changes, on this Fourth Industrial Revolution. They're just, because they don't like the people criticizing it preemptively, they're just going to say, well, it must be a good thing because Majid Nawaz sucks or whatever.
Yeah. In just the same way that this happened with Trump, where Trump could actually say something that's totally correct and right on occasion. And, yeah, you know, if Trump said during his presidency, I think it's a good thing if you brush your teeth every day, I could just about imagine, you know, there goes the mainstream progressive left brushing your teeth is evil. You know, brushing your teeth is terrible for you. It's like, no matter what he says, they're going to do the opposite. So I think you're right that part of it is a personality thing, you know, where someone telling you the truth, but you've been conditioned for whatever reason to see them as bad or an enemy or whatever, you're going to assume the opposite is true.
Well, I highlighted my own bias there because, like I said, like it felt like Majin Nawaz was going a little nuts for a while to me. But, you know, then when I actually listened to what he had to say, I was like, OK, well, he's making points that I would like to take seriously, that they seem reasonable to take seriously and judge for myself, you know. But like that dismissiveness in my head was there and I recognize it in myself. And that's what's kind of scary is when you recognize your own vulnerabilities like that, you realize, holy shit. Everybody has his vulnerabilities and a lot of people aren't going to acknowledge them or even realize they're there.
Yeah. Yeah. And like anything else, right? The first step is admitting you have a problem. I think, you know, nobody can eliminate those tendencies in all of our psychology. But if you're aware that they're there, at least some of the time, you'll be able to kind of, you know, identify them when they pop up and figure out, you know, ways to try and mitigate them. I will say, I do think another factor too, particularly when we're talking about like the very, very kind of like blue pilled normie types, right? The types that turn on CNN, watch it for a few minutes and go, all right, I know what's going on in the world. Those people, I think partly you'll never wake them up to things like, for example, the World Economic Forum crowd's plans for us and everything like that, in part because It's frightening, honestly, when you sit and listen to Majid Nawaz or somebody else like that go through what these people really do want to do to our societies. It's frightening and depressing. It's scary. And so I think there's a tendency of a certain type of person to just simply la, 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 just, you know, blind eye to any sort of bad news. These are the same people that like won't prepare for natural disasters and economic disasters and whatever. Because the first step to prepare for things like natural disasters and economic disasters is to realize that they're possible. That you know, if you're in Florida and you want to prepare for a hurricane, or if you're in California and you want to prepare for earthquakes and wildfires or whatever, the first step is like staring full in the face that like this can happen. You know, a storm or an earthquake or a wildfire can like obliterate my house and everything I own, or, you know, cause all sorts of disruption and distress. And, you know, I think that's why a lot of people do not take proper preparations for those sorts of things. And I think it's the same tendency of people. I think there's a psychological term for it, but I can't think of it off the top of my head, where basically you willfully ignore potential threats and dangers because it is depressing and scary to think about them. And as a result, you refuse to prepare for them. So,
right. Yeah. It's like, I don't know what the term is off the top of my head, but what you're talking about is people's attempts at thwarting cognitive dissonance. Like that's, you know, and I know there's a term for that. I just can't think of it either, but it's, yeah. And that makes sense to me too, because I mean, it only started to make sense to me when I moved to California, and I've only been through a couple earthquakes and they've been kind of minor. We're always being told that the big one is coming, but that's the thing, is that I think if you live in certain zones of the country, namely the East Coast or the West Coast, you have to, you know, you have a better grasp on the inherent risks that the world brings you, because you can't do anything to stop a hurricane. You can't do anything to stop an earthquake. You can conceivably do things to stop a wildfire, but they still happen. I mean, honestly, I didn't really wake up to the threat of wildfires until the ones that happened. Honestly, they happen every year, so they kind of all blend together. But the ones that were like truly nightmarish, the ones where you're going down the 405 and it looks like Mordor on either side of you. Like when that footage came out, that was when it hit me. I was like, oh, this is a thing I have to live with. And like, everybody who I know outside of California, at least, or outside of no one I know on the East Coast actually said anything about it, because I think they're used to things like that. But like all my Midwestern friends, family and acquaintances, they're all just like, oh, it's so scary. It's so scary. But like none of them are actually registering that. No. We live with this and we just have to sort of accept it and normalize it within ourselves while also being prepared. Like every house, well, hopefully every house in California is stocked with water, because we have to be. If an earthquake hits and the entire like power grid shuts down and things get really, you know, squirrely, we have to have water like to drink. We don't exactly have a lot of fresh water here. So yeah, it's there is a sense of preparedness, I think, that a lot of us will just internalize. But I think you're right that like the impulse to just not think about it is stronger, I think. And people doing anything that reminds them that this inherent risk is there, like going out to buy a bunch of jugs of water or whatever. I think that is too much for a lot of people. I don't know if I want to say that like people on, you know, the coast or in the danger zones have like an inherent sort of skill in dealing with these sorts of things, but I think we do have a better skill than most of the rest of the country.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's at least once every year or two, some part of Florida gets clobbered by a pretty serious hurricane. And sure, there's still lots of people many of whom have lived here for many years, who do nothing don't even do the most basic preparations. And yeah, I don't understand it, but there's large enough numbers of them that to me, this is a pretty widespread psychological phenomenon of just deliberately, you know, turning a blind eye to threats because it's stressful to think about them. And in order to prepare for them, you have to think about them, and it's stressful.
Well, and you just got me thinking, that's another sort of, and this actually is a cycle because, you know, it's in nature, is natural disasters.
Mm-hmm.
Natural disasters tend to be, I don't know if they're the ignition or if they're the gasoline being poured on the fire of, you know, of changes, but they tend to have ripple effects. And, you know, yeah, obviously we can question whether or not, like, or rather the origin of COVID-19, we can question that. I think, you know, it's pretty reasonable to assume that there was some unnatural elements to that at this point. Just it's reasonable to at least talk about it, I'll say. But it's still a natural disaster in the sense that it's an illness. It's a pandemic. Pandemics cause, I mean, we talked about that about it's going on a year and a half now. You know, pandemics have ripple effects. Natural disasters have ripple effects. Like the Great Awakenings that we were speaking of, they tend to coincide with natural disasters of some kind. A lot of the time, I shouldn't say all the time, but a lot of the time they do. Floods, hurricanes, meteors, whatever. Like it's one of those things that like does kind of speak to the idea that we do find ourselves trapped in certain kinds of cycles. And I think the cycles are the natural ones, most likely, because you're never not going to have a pandemic. Pandemics always happen. That's the one thing Bill Gates gets right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to cycle back to what I was saying before and say that, so, you know, the way I was thinking about it is you've got these many different kind of rhythms or cycles that are, you know, periodically going through birth, growth, decay, and death of, these different aspects of social change, economic, generational, religious, party system, mm-hmm. you know, politics. And they're all kind of on different time spans. I don't think they're synchronized, you know. So maybe one of them is swinging every 20 years, say, just throwing this out hypothetically, and another one is you know, going through a 30-year cycle, and another one's going through a 50-year cycle. And so, but where the really big shifts happen are when you have several of those coming together at once. So, for example, if you had a major generational shift coincide with a major religious revival and a major political shift and a major economic transformation all happening simultaneously, that's when you have, in the way I'm thinking about this, that's when you have what you're talking about, which is this just like across the board paradigm shift that includes almost everything as far as, you know, social life, as far as, you know, ideology, values in the deeper sense, also political, you know, preferences and things like that, also religious attitudes and so on and so forth. And yeah, I think anyway, that's the way I was thinking about it in my head. You've got these different cycles going independently of each other, each on their own rhythm, but every now and then, just because of coincidence, they all hit the change
right
part of the cycle at roughly around the same time. And that's when things get really interesting, as we might say.
And I think the generational cycle you speak of, it's less about who's rising because it's a lot of people. It's Generation X, Y, and Z. Like, all of us are, you know, we have quite a bit of life ahead of us, you know, and the boomers are on their way out. That's the generational shift. And I think that that is causing a sort of like that's causing a ripple effect. But again, like you're saying, it's like they're all coinciding at the same time and colliding with each other and creating a new sort of reality. I mean, that's sort of something that's interesting because like I was telling you before, I've been looking into the Jacksonian revolution, for lack of a better term, or realignment actually is a better word. And what that was in the early 1820s was really finally when the old guard of the revolutionaries and those who were directly descended from them, like John Quincy Adams, that's when they were basically like, okay, well, you know, they're out and this new generation is in. So I'm thinking that might be the generational shift that occurred back then. Because I was listening to a lot of interviews with experts about Jackson specifically and about that era, and they all seem to agree that that was fundamentally the biggest shift. Was it was finally the American project was finally untethered from the revolution in the most direct ways. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I definitely think there's some truth to that. Also, I think when I look at the Jacksonian era, there's another thing happening simultaneously that also contributes to the change, which is the Jackson era is the first period in American history where the states west of Appalachia, the trans-Appalachian, you know, Old West, are becoming states and thus are having an impact on the political mm-hmm. system. So it's no longer just the original states along the Atlantic coast. Now Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, etc. are all – and Jackson represents that as well. Aside from a generational change, he also represents the rising West, as do many of the other leading politicians of that era, like Henry Clay, you know, who's on the opposite side of Jackson on politics and ideology. But one thing they do have in common is they both, you know, represent the impact of the West. And maybe, you know, Lincoln from Illinois is like a culmination of that, you know, at the close of the Jacksonian era.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you because I just thought of it, and it came up when we were like shooting ideas back and forth earlier, that it's obvious, at least to me, that the first major realignment, if it wasn't I want to give credit to Thomas Jefferson and those guys who separated from the Federalists. That is a realignment in a way, but that feels just more like the first, like an alignment, if you will. There was no realignment there necessarily. But it just doesn't feel as significant to me as a Jacksonian one. But my question is, where does the Civil War fit into this? Because you are as close to anybody I know, an expert on the Civil War after your epic series. So where does that fit into the schema of a realignment happening back in the 19th century?
Yeah, I would say that probably I'm not sure how much it affected the cultural side of things, the culture, the values in the outside of politics realm. I think that the Civil War, part of it is like an economic revolution in a way, but it's also a political thing. So it's a big deal in the sense that, number one, the issue of slavery was, you know, settled. Obviously, that's a big deal. But it also was it was the end of the Jackson era in the sense that, you know, if you look at Abraham Lincoln's political ideas, right, for most of his career, he didn't really talk much about slavery, hardly at all. And he didn't start to make it a big deal in his political rhetoric until the 1850s, when the Kansas-Nebraska dispute suddenly made slavery like the biggest issue in the world. And you kind of had to take a hard stance one way or the other on it. But if you look at for most of his political career from, I think he first ran for office in Illinois in 1832, up until about 1852, when slavery became the big thing, His main political fixations were basically he was a Henry Clay guy. He was pushing kind of the neo-Hamiltonian idea of strong central government, high tariff, National Bank. He was a big supporter of the National Bank and government subsidies to so-called internal improvements, which by Lincoln's era were coming to include not just roads and canals and things, which he supported, big government infrastructure projects there, but also railroads. By the time Lincoln had been in politics for a decade or two, railroads were becoming a big thing, and he, like Henry Clay, was very much a supporter of the government subsidizing the building of railroads. Mm. So when Lincoln wins and gets control of the federal government, and then the fact that the South drops out of the Union, which means they're no longer participating in Congress, that means, you know, the part of the country that would have had the most people in Congress pushing back against this Henry Clay program of Lincoln are, for obvious reasons, not participating in the U.S. Congress during those years. Yeah. And so there's way less. I mean, yeah, there's some Northern Democrats here and there who still were pushing back against this. But, you know, the Republicans were able to just dominate because the South wasn't participating in the system. And so Lincoln's able to get everything he wants, practically. You know, I did a bonus episode for show supporters about the other side of the Lincoln administration, the side that you don't hear about, which is his domestic policies that are not directly related to the war. So, you know, I talked about all this sort of stuff where Lincoln, yeah, he's doing all the things he did in order to prosecute the war, but he's also being very generous to the railroad companies. He's also starting the process of resurrecting a national bank, although he doesn't quite do it entirely. He creates like a halfway house to central banking under the National Banking Acts. And, you know, he was a big subsidizer of railroad interests, and, you know, and I called him Corporate Abe in that episode, because I really think that's what he was. And for obvious reasons, the domestic non-war parts of his presidency are usually just completely ignored and overlooked because the war is going on, and that obviously is a big dramatic affair.
Right.
But, you know, when you look at what the other hand was doing while he's doing the war, he's basically putting in place the Hamilton through Henry Clay program. When Henry Clay died, Lincoln spoke at his funeral, I believe, gave a eulogy, basically said, you know, Henry Clay's the greatest American statesman who ever lived. So,
okay. Yeah.
I definitely think the war was a realignment of a sort. Was it as much of a total realignment as some of these other ones we might talk about? I don't know. You know, it's tempting to say yes, just because the war itself was so bloody and dramatic, and obviously sure. Did have all kinds of important changes that came about as a result. You know, it definitely solidified in the argument about where relative power should lie, the states or the federal government. It definitely, you know, the war and its aftermath definitely strengthened the hand of the federal government quite a bit over what it had been up until then. And you know, another big change that came out of the Civil War that I think often gets overlooked, but does have long lasting impacts to this day, is that it's the Civil War and its aftermath when the South first starts to become the Bible Belt. That's when the South starts to become more religious generally than the North. Prior to the Civil War in American history, yes, there were religious revivals that included parts of the South, and yes, you know, there were religious people in the South and whatever, but I think if you were just, you know, saying overall, big picture, what part of the country is the more religious part prior to the Civil War, it's actually the Northeast. It's New England, upstate New York, and a few areas around the Great Lakes.
Right. Yeah, because I was going to say, the Second Great Awakening was its ferment was the burned over district, quote unquote, in upstate New York. And before that, the First Great Awakening, that was, you know, hotbed Puritan New England. You know, I mean, it was like right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Both of the First and Second Great Awakenings both started in the Northeast and then only started to spread into the South later. And my impression is that on average, during the first two Great Awakenings in American history, the stronger zeal overall was in the North. Like, not only did it start there, but that, you know, the denominations that popped up tended to be more, for lack of a better term, extreme in the North. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as the more like zealous, pietistic
evangelical
right.
type, you know, and also unorthodox, right? Like the Mormons sure. and the Seventh-day Adventists and things like that, mm-hmm. that, you know, were further outside the mainstream of American Protestantism at the time. Whereas in the South, in the first two Great Awakenings, it's still closer to mainline. Like, it's like, okay, you know, you get Baptists and Methodists and things like that. And yes, they're a little bit more, you know, evangelical, than right. say the Episcopalian or Presbyterian church at the time. But the Baptists and Methodists, I don't think are ever quite as evangelical and pietistic as some of the denominations that you only find in the North during those awakenings.
I have a couple hypotheses about why that might be, and maybe you could just tell me why it is, or at least tell me if I'm onto something here, that the impression I have is that the rise of the Bible Belt after the Civil War has this sort of like a lot of it has to do with the rise of the Black church. There was a lot more attendance to churches, especially after emancipation. So I would imagine that plays a part. But I'm wondering if the other factor that like pushed people into more of a religious zeal down South was the loss of the Civil War.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. I talked a bit in one of the latter episodes of my Civil War series all those years ago.
I'm trying to remember which one, because I do remember you talking about it. Yeah, but I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, well, there was a really interesting book that I read called Culture of Defeat. And it's by a really interesting writer. I think I've read one other book by him that's called Three New Deals, and it's comparing the government policies of fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, and FDR's New Deal in terms in particular of like the economic corporatism and all those sorts of things. And anyway, it's I think he's German by his name. He probably is. If not, he's Austrian or something. It's a guy named Wolfgang Schivelbusch. And
he gives my name a run for its money.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he's some sort of like a not a formal academic historian, like doesn't have a PhD in history or whatever. So he's very unorthodox. I always find him very interesting. So anyway, the book in question that dealt with the another thing I like about him is that it seems like, at least based on the two books I've read by him, he likes to do comparative history. And to me, that's always fascinating to do comparative history.
Sure.
But anyway, Culture of Defeat, he's looking at and comparing and contrasting three different instances in relatively recent history of nations that went through like a massive defeat in war. And what it did to like the psychology and culture of them. And so he's looking at France when it's defeated in the Franco-Prussian War, and then Germany when it's defeated in World War One, and then also looking at the South after the Civil War, and the way that the different ways that these three different societies each reacted to the same overall circumstance of not just losing a war, but losing a war in a way that was particularly traumatic to the psychology of the nation, right? Because like the Franco-Prussian War, even though it was a relatively brief war and not that big, you know, in terms of body count compared to something like World War One or the Napoleonic Wars, psychologically, the Franco-Prussian War was a big deal for the French. I mean, they really got stunned by not just that the Prussians beat him, but like how one-sided it was. I mean, it's just so bad.
Well, and also wasn't leading up to that, France was the dominant land power in Europe for centuries at that point, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, so yeah, that's going to bruise your self-image in a major way. I don't want to jump ahead too much, but I just suddenly thought, like, we're not at war right now, but there is a general sense that America's on the back foot right now. And I have to wonder if that's going to produce a similar effect. Maybe not as traumatic, but I don't know. We can jump back. Let's put a pin in that. I just needed to say it out loud so I wouldn't forget it. Cause that just made me think of that. But yeah, that's really interesting.
I wanted to, basically, you know, if I remember right, he argues in the book that this dramatic increase in religiosity in the South, and just in general of kind of like, you know, the South was always in various ways culturally conservative, but I think it actually becomes more culturally conservative after the Civil War than it really was before. And, you know, just in general becomes more reactionary that sort of thing.
I can understand that, especially from what we were talking about before, because they don't get to have slavery anymore, but you can't just beat the desire to be conservative about issues like that out of somebody. I mean, we sure as hell tried to do that with, you know, Germans after World War II, but, you know, as I covered in one of my episodes, that didn't work very well, at least not initially. It requires time, like generations. And so that makes sense to me that, like, you're defeated. You're a Southerner. You're defeated. You don't get to have slaves anymore. You don't get to support slavery as an institution anymore. And it's obvious that you're the loser. So what do you do to cope with that? To cope with that, you latch on to conservative values in a different way.
Yeah. And let me throw out another comparison. And I can't remember if this is one that I sort of thought of on my own, or if I read this somewhere a long, long time ago and just can't remember where it was. But another interesting comparison with the defeated South is the kind of Islamic world when the Ottoman Empire goes into serious decline and falls way behind the West.
Oh, yeah.
And how, and then, you know, once the Middle East becomes largely, you know, the plaything of Western imperialists, that the link between that and Islam in many of those areas becoming more fundamentalist. Whereas if you look back at when those places were relatively innovative and prosperous and doing as well or better than the West, in those areas,
in terms of things like mathematics,
various, you know, Islamic renaissances that happened.
Yes.
Where there's really was a lot of, you know, scientific work and things like this, that, you know, Islam during those periods when those societies were doing very well tended to be less fundamentalist and, you know, all that stuff, tended to be more small L liberal, more tolerant, whatever. And so there's sort of a parallel there too, where, you know, when the South was doing relatively better, I think they tended to be less rigidly fundamentalist and dogmatic about religion and less intolerant of dissent and all that. And then once they're defeated, you know, one of the ways that they cope with that is to latch on. And maybe it was in the Shivelbush book. Maybe there was a part in that book where he actually talked a little bit about even though it's not one of the big three he's comparing, he might have had a passage in there where he brought up, you know, the Islamic world and how it kind of became more reactionary culturally and religiously when it kind of started to decline and fall.
I can tell you, I can actually just give you a bit of evidence that maybe he brings up if it wasn't his book, that's absolutely true, that the decline of the Ottoman Empire is what really, I think, is at the core of where reactionary Islamist ideology got its rise, because the sort of thinker writer who most inspired Osama bin Laden was a man named Sayyid Qutb. And he was this extremely anti-Western, reactionary, conservative Islamist who I believe he went to America and then wrote about how disgusted he was at our decadence and how, like, you know how liberal we were. Mm-hmm. And his writings were very influential in those circles of Islamist thinkers and eventually doers. I shouldn't call them doers. That sounds really messed up, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. And I think there's a parallel to be made too.
It was the 1920s, by the way, I should add that. So it was right in the middle of the decline of the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
So,
like the last sort of phases of its collapse and transformation, right? Cause World War One is basically what does it in. Another interesting comparison in that whole idea of a place that, you know, experiences, you know, a major national psychological trauma and then kind of goes into more conservatism, reactionaryism, et cetera, is Russia itself since the fall of the Soviet Union. Like, you know, it seems like and Putin himself is sort of, you know, fostering this, but also kind of riding the wave of it, of cultural conservatism, turning back to the Orthodox Church, turning back to like old school Russian kind of things, you know, as a way to cope with, you know, the experience of the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And then also, to be fair, the way that the West has often treated Russia in those 30 years, you know, it's really, when you look into the details of how the US and Western Europe really did not do a great job of sort of being magnanimous and generous.
We were sore winners.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's occurred to me recently, by the way, that basically and I can't remember if I posted something about this on social media yet or not, but basically, think what, when you look at the way Russia has been treated by the West overall from, say, like 1992 to now, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I'm looking at that now and I'm thinking, that is the exact same historical phenomenon as the way Germany was treated at the end of World War One, only it was done gradually over 30 years instead of done, you know, in a year or two at the end of the war with the Versailles Treaty. But it's the same sort of deal where you have a country that's defeated and the leaders of the victorious countries, instead of having the wisdom and foresight and prudence to say, yes, you know, we won, but let's be generous, magnanimous winners, because otherwise, if we're, you know, gloating and rubbing their nose in it and mistreating them in various ways and exploiting their loss, we're going to set them up for wanting to get revenge sooner or later. Mm-hmm. And I always compare.
Careful, you're sounding like Keynes.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one thing I think he was absolutely dead right on. If you look back, you know, the contrast is always the way that the victorious great powers treated France at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, where, you know, they required regime change. They required, yeah, Napoleon can't be in charge of France anymore, and restored the Bourbon monarchy, which, you know, that may not have been the greatest move, but I don't know what else they could have done at the time, realistically. And then, you know, France had to give up territory it had conquered during those wars, but France didn't lose any of the territory that it held prior to the revolution in those wars. And it did not, you know, have Alsace and Lorraine stripped of it, that kind of thing. It did not have crushing financial reparations payments placed on it. Like, you know, so to me, not that it was perfect, but by comparison, either with how Germany was treated at the end of World War One or how Russia has been treated since the end of the Cold War, the leaders of 1815 in Europe were far wiser, you know, statesmen, far, far more prudence. You know, they realized, like, yeah, we can't be too harsh on France. Otherwise, if we do, we're pretty much guaranteeing that in a decade or two or three, France is going to be looking to get its revenge against the whole frickin' continent of Europe again, and we're going to end up in another disastrous, you know, multi-decade-long war that completely threatens to overturn everything.
I can speculate why, at least in modern times, why that lack of foresight or lack of wisdom has prevailed with the defeat of nations like Germany and Russia. And I suspect it's because we have largely abandoned honor culture. And while on the ground and at home, I think that's probably a good thing because, you know, dignity is more important than honor. I think if you understand honor culture, though, by living in it, then you are more likely to empathize or be able to empathize with the notion of a people wanting revenge for humiliation, for defeat. And in a way, it's even more inevitable that that's happened now because some have said, and I forgot where I read this, there was an article about it. I want to say actually in The Atlantic. They still occasionally do some really good stuff there. But it was from like 5 years ago or something, that we've just gone full into not being even a dignity culture anymore, but being a victimhood culture. I mean, we know this in so many ways. I don't know if it's necessarily a fact, but what I'm saying is the further away we get from honor culture, the more likely it seems to me that we could just keep making the same mistake of not taking the notion that a nation will want revenge for something that we don't even remember, you know? So I don't know. Maybe I'm just spitballing that. I have no idea if that's true. It's just, you know, a thought that came to my head.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely something there. I think that you're onto something with that. I think there's something else possibly at play simultaneously, in creating this, you know, increasing unwillingness, say, of victorious leaders to have the prudence to think long term and, you know, deal reasonably with defeated enemies. Another factor I think playing into this is that, unlike in 1815, much of the world is some sort of, at least nominally, democracy, right? And so, whereas, you know, even in the most democratic of the victorious allies countries of 1815 would be Britain. But Britain at the time, yeah, they had parliament, but vast majority of British people couldn't vote for it, you know? It was still nothing remotely like real mass democracy. But by the time you get to World War One, more places do have mass democracy. And when you combine mass democracy with the horrific expenses of a war like World War One or subsequent major wars, propaganda, mass propaganda becomes way more important and therefore way more widespread and way more widely used. In 1810, governments didn't need to and didn't engage in gigantic mass propaganda campaigns, in part because of technology.
I would imagine, yeah, well, I would imagine a lot of the citizens were still illiterate, so propaganda is not exactly going to work if it's written down, at least.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, the only media you really had were print of various types as well. Mm-hmm. And whereas by the 20th century, you're getting more and more, you know, media that you can use for propaganda. But basically, I think what happens is, if you look at a war like World War One or World War Two, or, you know, even something like the Cold War, that throughout those conflicts, the people are being just inundated for multiple generations, in the case of the Cold War, with propaganda demonizing the enemy, right? Well, mm-hmm. if you do that enough, and it really is internalized by the bulk of your mass voter population, you can't flip that switch off. If you're the leader, even if you are a wise mm-hmm. leader with a lot of prudence, you can't just turn that switch off instantaneously and say, okay, boom, we won today, therefore everybody needs to just completely delete from their brains and attitudes and instincts all of the propaganda we've indoctrinated you with during the conflict, right? And so the leaders themselves are boxed in by the monster they created in terms of propagandized voters who look at the enemy as a demon. And so, you know, why, for example, did the leaders of Britain and France, why were they so insistent on raking Germany over the coals in 1918? Well, at least part of it is that in Britain and France, those were pretty democratic places by World War One, and they had been heavily propagandizing their people, especially Britain, but France, you know, almost as much, propagandizing their people, demonizing the Germans in order to keep the war effort going. Okay, now you've won. You can't then tell your people, okay, yeah, we told you for 4 years that the Kaiser is a literal monster who wants to take over the planet and enslave us all, and that all Germans are like that too. It's not just a bad regime, right? There's something fundamental about the German people that's evil. And then say, mm-hmm. you know, and also tell your people for 4 years that the war is 100% caused by them. And after the people have been not just propagandized, but have suffered, right? They've suffered loss of loved ones. They've suffered economic devastation from the war. You can't then be a politician in a democratic system and go, all right, I know you want to really get revenge on them, rub their nose in it, take all the money you can to you know, pay us back for the damages we've suffered, but that's really an unwise thing to do. And so to me, it's a case where the politician becomes captive of his own mob that he helped to create mm-hmm. and whip up. So I think that's another factor that's driving this tendency of leaders to not have wisdom and foresight. And plus, in general, the more democratic a system is, especially if it has very frequent elections, the more politicians are incentivized and trained to not think long term. Because a lot of the time, the thing that's the right thing to do for the long term is the less
popular option. No one's going to want to support it.
I mean, that's how it is in politics just as much as in daily life, right? Like, it's more fun to eat Fruit Loops and watch Netflix for 12 hours a day in the moment. But obviously, in the long run, it's no good. Whereas, you know, to eat something healthy and then go work out really hard in the moment may seem like the less fun and pleasurable option. But, you know... And I think in general that there's been a decrease in time preference amongst people in general, and then the politicians reflect that, responding to incentives and circumstances where just in general people, mm-hmm. I think, on average, do sacrifice the long term much more often for short term pleasure and comfort. So and you see this in obesity rates. You see this in, you know, all kinds of things.
Yeah, you're highlighting something that's part of something I've been noticing and talking about sometimes, and that you're highlighting the ecosystem aspect of a culture, of a political culture, specifically a democratic one, it sounds like, in a lot of ways. And, you know, for all the strengths that democracies have, you know, it's important to always highlight the weaknesses. And what you're talking about is essentially what, you know, what us in the podcasting biz like to call audience capture, where you're only delivering what your audience wants to hear rather than giving them the harsh truth. It's basically the opposite of what Orwell said was the duty of someone I believe he said of a writer, to say that what the people don't want to hear is the most important thing to tell them. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but what I, as you were saying all that, I was just thinking that there is a certain, I mean, I think at this point, you know me well enough to know that I really resist anybody trying to paint America in a unique light in for good or bad. Because I don't think, I mean, I do think we're unique in some ways, but I think it's overstated. And a lot of that is propaganda, I think. But I think what's interesting about America, though, is that even as far back as, I mean, specifically the Jacksonian era, to jump back to that, we did have a very engaged public. I mean, yes, only white men could vote, but women played a part in the voting process. And apparently this this historian I was listening to, he was saying that there was a lot of cases where a husband would vote because a certain way because his wife told him to.
Sure.
And it wasn't just because, you know, it's like get her off my back, you know, Al Bundy style, like just, you know, she's annoying or whatever, but it was more because women were very politically engaged back then. But despite not having the right to vote, they engaged that way. And what I'm getting at here is that I think America has had that issue of propaganda really since its founding in a lot of ways. I mean, the first newspapers in America were pamphlets for the parties. So while we did have lower rates of literacy back then, obviously, I still think there's something to the idea that this inundation of propaganda, maybe that is what drives the cycles we've been talking about of realignments, because we've always been propagandized is the sense I'm getting. I mean, am I off on that?
Well, I mean, I think there's always been some amount of mass propaganda going on in the United Sure. States. I think there's been an ongoing significant shift, though, both in, how would I put this, in the amount of propaganda being done and mm-hmm. in just in terms of the different technologies that have come along in the last 100 or 200 years. You know, I mean, you know, you start off, this country is created after the printing press is already a thing. But then eventually you get, you know, radio and TV and movies and internet and, you know, everything else. And so propaganda became, I think, much more gradually totalistic in that it's everywhere mm-hmm. in a way that, you know, in 1850, if you just chose to not pick up and read a newspaper or a pamphlet or whatever, you're fine. Whereas today, unless you're Ted Kaczynski living in the woods, you know, you're going to be barraged with right. propaganda every time you do anything. So I think it's become more totalistic that way.
Sure. And I haven't read Edward Bernays's book of same name, Propaganda. And I want to, but so maybe he talks about this, but I think what's so genius about the totalistic proliferation of propaganda is that you don't even have to have people consciously trying to propagandize for the propaganda to exist and be effective. The incentives just are there, to create something that the people want. You know what I mean? Like the propaganda has become in a lot of ways, because of its totalistic nature, almost an unconscious process. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And another aspect of propaganda that people often, you know, who've never really studied it or thought about it really deeply don't realize is I think most people, the idea of propaganda in their head that they have is that it's always top down under central yes. control. And
they think of Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia and that they're just like, that's just what it is because it's just controlled by the state and that's all propaganda
right,
is.
Right. Yeah. Whereas I think the propaganda that oftentimes is the most effective is that which is more horizontal and sometimes even bottom up in mm-hmm. addition to top down, like that never goes away, but it's also more decentralized. So, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean, even though it's decentralized in terms of the actual institutions and organizations, doesn't mean they're not coordinating in various ways. So if mm-hmm. if you look at the United States currently, it's not like all the propaganda or even most of the propaganda is directly coming from the United States government's Ministry of Truth or Committee on Public Information or whatever.
Right.
That instead, you know, you've got these nominally private media corporations, and then you also have, you know, in addition to like news media corporations, you also have the entertainment media corporations, which also are loaded with propaganda. And then you've got another thing that I think is highly full of propaganda, which is the schooling system. And so there's no like one department that's like forcing all these different institutions to work off the same script, but there's various means by which they're sometimes on purpose and sometimes just sort of naturally through responding to incentives and things. That's what I was talking about.
They
do coordinate their narrative. And like I mentioned in my first Dirty Baker's Dozen episode, that I think tacit collusion or signaling is very often what's going on too, where, you know, a few key public figures and media outlets and whatever put out a particular narrative, and lesser institutions and even individuals that are in that same propaganda camp, they don't have to be told, this is the narrative, this is the script, make sure you all say horse dewormer every time you bring up ivermectin, right? I don't think, in some cases, I think there might be, like, actual orders being given, for example, from maybe, let's say, like, someone like Klaus Schwab or the CEO of a major media corporation or whatever. Also, sometimes orders might be going out to media outlets through the CIA, which, you know, is basically has infiltrated the media since the 1950s. So I'm not saying that the top-down, centrally controlled coordination never happens, but I'm saying I don't think it's what's going on in the majority of cases. I think it's a much more complicated, horizontal thing.
It's organic in the sense that something genetically engineered is still technically an organic life form, you know? And what I mean is that, because I was just thinking a good example of that is of the incentive structure is, you know, the recent Joe Rogan controversy. It was a Twitter account that was an arm of a DNC super PAC, but regardless, like whatever the first major media outlet picked it up, you know, whoever it was, they picked it up. It did numbers because it's talking about Rogan because it's a, you know, it's a very popular topic. And therefore, it incentivized more people to report the same story in the same way because they want that traffic too. So therefore, that's why it becomes a thing. And then that incentivizes the responses to it. And that becomes its own little ecosystem as well. And, you know, and I'm just putting aside, you know, the debate on, you know, the subject altogether, because I don't think it really matters for the purposes of this point. I think the point is that there's such a robust ecosystem all operating off of attention, eyes, clicks, whatever you want to call it, that any effort to propagandize that way, that, you know, there's no effort required at all. It just does it on its own, if that makes sense. And I think that, you know, as you say, it didn't start out that easy with, you know, within American history because, you know, there's so many barriers there. But then as technology progressed, propaganda just became easier. And because, you know, again, everything has trade-offs, like the trade-off to a capitalist system is that it runs off incentives, and those incentives can be warped very easily and sometimes even manipulated. And I think that, you know, it's one of those things, though, that I have to wonder, has it just been baked into our system since the beginning, that way of like looking at things? The idea of, again, to bring it up again, the idea of propagandizing the masses, like, is that just what American democracy is? Am I overstating that?
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Yeah, it might be a combination of sort of mass democracy, which then, in order for the elites to maintain control, right? This is what Wilson talked about when he talked about modern democracy, which is politics gets made more democratic in terms of the number of people who can vote and in terms of the number of things that they can vote on or for. And at the same time, though, it's not democratic in the sense that two things. One is Wilson wants the people to not really spontaneously come up with their own desires and wishes in terms of the policies they want. He wants.
Yeah, they don't know any better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Instead, enlightened great men like Woodrow Wilson are going to use their powers of rhetoric to tell the masses what the masses should want. And then it's up to the masses to essentially rubber stamp what their elite progressive leaders have told them they're supposed to want by then dutifully supporting the policies that their leaders have told them are the right ones. So it's not democratic in that way, because it's basically top down. The leader tells the people what to vote for. And then the other way that it's not democratic is that Wilson simultaneously wants this large permanent administrative state, right? Which is basically a technocracy, but he doesn't use the word yet because it wasn't coined in the 1880s. But, you know, if you read the study of administration, which he wrote in the 1880s, he's basically talking about technocracy, that he wants much of what the government actually is and does. Like, oh yeah, okay, you know, your president and your congressman are elected by the people, whatever. But that much of what the government actually is and does is this permanent bureaucratic deep state where people are there and, you know, for their entire working lives, other than maybe occasionally bopping into the private sector through the revolving door. But, you know, where the people, the president can replace the people at the top of like the State Department or the Pentagon or whatever. But 99.9% of the people who actually comprise that institution are the same people who were there for the last three presidents. And in most instances, they can't really be fired unless they like commit a crime or something like that. So you make politics.
Well, and then if you see what happened with, you know, the revelations, I believe it was the CIA, and how this is dark, but how much child porn and child molestation was going on there, and how none of these people saw any real consequences, except I think like one of them got fired.
Yeah. Well, the national security, particularly the secretive intelligence agency parts of the national security state, they're able to use their particular powers and skills that they have to get away with things that, you know, if there was a major,
they're like Hollywood. They are they're a morally broken rogue state, as I've called Hollywood. Like that, I mean, they are a rogue state within a state.
Yeah. The CIA, and also in various ways the NSA, the FBI, as well as, you know, some of the lesser known intelligence agencies, they're able to use their powers of things like secrecy and the other powers that they have to protect themselves from scrutiny, up to and including, I think in some cases, literally blackmailing members of Congress to protect themselves.
Sure.
You know, that this stuff did not end with J. Edgar Hoover dying, not by a long shot, in a way that the other departments of the government wouldn't be able to protect. So, for example, I don't think if there was a major epidemic of pedophilia in the Department of Agriculture or the Post Office, you know, the Postal Service, I don't think they'd be able to be as effective at covering it up and getting away with it for a long time and whatever as the CIA. They just don't have the same amount of tools to be secretive and cover things up and manipulate the media.
Right.
You know, so I think all the worst tendencies of permanent administrative bureaucracies get like amplified 1,000-fold when you're dealing with something like the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, that have all these special powers that most of the other departments of government don't have.
Well, they're in control of, I keep pointing at the word in my head is observation, surveillance. That's the word. It's like that definitely helps with that. I'm also, by the way, I'm really glad you brought up Wilson, because I wanted to jump back to Wilson as sort of the origin point of the current alignment we're in that's being realigned potentially right now, because I think that was the last meaningful one, like I was saying at the beginning. And I do also want my listeners, because this show's going to go up on both our feeds. I want my listeners to go listen to your episode about Wilson's paper, the study of administration. Or was it a book?
It was an essay or like an article, like an academic journal article, I think, originally.
Like it, I can't stress enough how weirdly compelling a podcast just discussing an essay about administration, how weird it is, how compelling that podcast was that you did, where you're just talking about what Wilson is saying and I'm riveted the whole way through. And I think more than once you are responding just sort of off the cuff about Wilson and you say, what the fuck are you talking about?
His writing is like just so painful it took me so long when I later did. So I did that one episode just on that one essay, because I felt that one essay was so important to understanding
ideas
and also the country he created, essentially the system he created. But it's like listening to Klaus Schwab saying all these things he's going to do to you, years before he does them. It's like he's telling you what he has in store for you, and you might want to listen because it might not be what you want. After that, I eventually did the whole, like, I don't even remember how long it was, 4 hours or something, on like looking overall at as a whole at all of his academic writings, which very few historians have done. Very few historians have done more than scratch the surface of his academic writings. But man, when you do that, you get
connected them to his policies as a governor and then president. Yeah. Like, nobody's really made those connections.
Yeah. It's
like, that's so important. He's like you said, he's writing down what he wants to do and then he does it. Like, it's so, like, that's so weird to me. Maybe not enough time has passed for people to do that. I don't know. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a reappraisal of Wilson yet. I feel like very few people are reappraising him. I mean, he seems to get mostly positive press.
The only aspect of him that has been reappraised is his racism, because,
which is good, but that's so tangential. Well,
yeah, to me, it's like that is a reason to not like him, but to act like, because basically since the establishment. Ever since Wilson's era, the establishment, both of politics, but also academia and much of the corporate media, has basically been progressive. Like, I would argue that progressivism has been the dominant default ideology of the United States since at least the 19-teens, if not the
1912. Yeah.
I mean, you can even argue it's starting with Teddy Roosevelt's presidency before Wilson. But that it had already progressivism had largely captured all of academia by about the 1890s or maybe at the latest 1900. It then rapidly was taking over much of the big media outlets. And then, you know, it establishes itself, I think, firmly as the dominant default political ideology with FDR's election in 1932. Like, it all roads lead back to Wilson in a lot of ways, not just because of what he did during his presidency, but because of the ideological academic work he did for decades before he got into politics. That, like, this all we've been living in Woodrow Wilson's America ever since. I did want to raise the possibility, though, that if there was a Wilsonian realignment, that I think maybe a better way to look at it, instead of like pinpointing just his presidency or his election and saying, boom, that's where the switch got flipped. I think it was more gradual and a little bit more multifaceted.
Right. And that's what I think too.
To me, you know, his election of the presidency was maybe the single most important piece of it, but
it was the culmination, right?
Yeah. Although I think FDR's election is like the ultimate culmination of progressive, like flat out locking down, you know, the American system. So the way I think about it is, there's a 26-year period in which the shift occurs. The shift doesn't occur quickly in a single year or a single election or even a single presidency. The shift unfolds over the course of about 26 years, and I would say it starts in 1896 with the election of McKinley, who, even though in many ways he was still a typical Gilded Age kind of president. He ultimately gets pushed into war with Spain, which allows the large policy crowd like Teddy Roosevelt to start grabbing control of American foreign policy and really making it an overseas British Empire style policy. And then, after McKinley, progressivism starts to become a bigger force in American politics in both the TR and Wilson administrations. American entry into World War I is another major kind of milestone in this shift. And then there's like a brief kind of Indian summer partial swing back in the 1920s, particularly under Harding and Coolidge, where the American people express themselves at the polls vehemently against progressivism in those elections. Harding wins in a landslide in 1920. Coolidge gets reelected. You know, Harding dies partway through his term. Coolidge comes in. Coolidge gets reelected in a landslide in 1924. Herbert Hoover is kind of interesting because, unlike most people's impressions, Herbert Hoover is very much a progressive Republican. He's a fairly big government progressive guy. Yeah, he's a little bit different from Wilson, but not that much. He worked in the Wilson administration. He was Woodrow Wilson's food czar during World War I. He ran the food administration, which was very powerful war mobilization administration. And so there's this like brief kind of counterattack by the anti-progressive forces, call them conservative for lack of a better term, in the 20s. But then with the landslide victory of FDR and the Democrats in Congress starting in 1932 and then being able to just dominate American politics for the next couple decades, that to me, the real culmination where progressivism is like locked down its status as the dominant paradigm in throughout American institutions of power and influence is 1932. So yeah, I would say the ball kind of gets rolling in 1896. It accelerates with TR's presidency. It accelerates more with Wilson's presidency in World War One. Briefly swings back a bit for about a decade, and then election of FDR, beginning of the New Deal era. Like at that point, that is when not only does the Democratic does progressivism become the dominant ideology, the default ideology, but that's also when the Democratic Party becomes the dominant establishment party, which you could argue they really weren't from, say, 1860 to 1932. The Republicans tended to be,
because Wilson was a fluke. I mean, Wilson being a Democrat was just kind of a fluke, right?
Yeah. Basically, it was because of the Taft Teddy Roosevelt split, which split what normally would have been the unified Republican vote, because everybody pretty much agrees that most of the people who voted for Teddy Roosevelt would have ordinarily voted Republican in 1912, you know, when he's running as a bull moose. That, you know, yeah, maybe a few of the people who voted for Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 on the bull moose ticket were, you know, independents or even socialists or disaffected Democrats who were progressive Democrats, but maybe for one reason or another didn't like Wilson for some reason. But that the vast majority...
I can't imagine why.
Exactly. But the vast majority of voters who voted for TR would have just voted for whoever was the Republican if TR... As an independent wasn't an option. So yeah, it's 1932 when not just progressivism as an ideology, but the Democratic Party as its primary vehicle establishes itself as the dominant party. Because if you think about it, from 1932 until now, the Democrats have been the dominant party. Obviously, the Republicans have won the presidency a bunch of times during that time period, and they've had the majority in Congress, although less years than they've had the presidency. They weren't very good at winning Congress until the 1990s, but that even when Republicans are in the majority in Congress and have the White House, they're not able to do much of what they want to do. Usually all you got to do is look at the Trump years, right? You know, how much did the Republicans get done, even though for part of that they had legislature as well as the White House? It's because even when the Republicans take control of the White House and the Congress, There's a couple problems for them actually really having the power and influence that Democrats tend to have when they have control of those branches. One is that the Republicans, at least since 1932, have tended to be often not as good about staying unified when they're in power than the Democrats. Now, Democrats still have divisions, sure, but I think the Republicans are more prone to it, where, you know, you get a lot of like the Mitt Romney type Republicans who are going to go against what, you know, the mass of Republican voters really want, and sabotage from within. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the fact that even when the Republicans have the White House and big majorities in Congress, okay, the entire mainstream media, save a couple of outlets, is still totally dead set against them. Almost all of the deep state, including those powerful agencies like the FBI and CIA, are dead set against them usually. And so, you know, there's so much institutional resistance that they find themselves, and partly partly also I think the Republicans tend to be hamstrung by not realizing what they're up against, right? Like I think that was Trump's biggest problem in terms of being successful at getting stuff done he wanted to do, is he just did not at all grasp the depth of what he was up against in terms of these forces in the media and in the deep state and in other powerful institutions, like also academia and the public schooling system are also, you know, dominated by progressives. And doesn't matter if the Republicans get elected, they're still going to be pushing out the same, you know, ideological propaganda that they would otherwise. In fact, they amp it up, right? Think about how much academia and the media amped up their propaganda during the Trump years in response.
Well, it's because I think they recognized at some level, at least, and probably some people consciously recognized that what they were responding to was a potential for a complete realignment. I mean, that's sort of what I'm seeing these days. I wanted to also mention, though, that there's one thing Republicans are very good at uniting around, and that's just being against everything the Democrats do. They're usually very good at that.
Yeah, they're much more
with exceptions.
They're much more effective when they're in opposition than they are when they're in the majority and they actually want to do stuff. They're better at blocking things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but they're just apparently going to continue that into the near future, at least according to Mitch McConnell. But the thing that that's where I actually do sympathize with even the most blue-pilled, you know, blue-check having progressive douche when they say that the Republican Party is a party of reactionaryism. I'm like, yeah. That's very true. That's the one thing they're good at. And it seems like from what you're saying, they've basically, maybe not Republicans necessarily. Well, I guess it was Republicans. That basically is what they've been since Wilson for the most part, just a repudiation of what has become the norm.
Yeah. And that's why I'm saying, you know, especially post 1932, the Republicans become basically a permanent opposition party that's always on defense, even when they're in the majority. They're kind of always on defense. And so, you know, if you're only ever playing defense long term, you're not going to, you know, ever push things in your direction. The most effective you can be is just simply slowing down, you know, what the other side is pushing. And so, you know, Michael Malice does a great job of explaining this when he talks about this and says things like, you know, conservatism, or at least mainstream conservatism, is progressivism driving the speed limit. You know,
that's a
very
good one,
often
yeah.
Mainstream conservatives are basically they're defending the previous accomplishments of previous versions of progressivism or previous generations of progressives.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but that is perfect in how we account for a figure like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Reagan was...
Because some people try to count Reagan as another example of a realignment, and I'm thinking, no. That, like, the only ripple effect that had was the deification of him in the early 2000s. I have not heard a single conservative I know invoke the name of Reagan except with contempt.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of good books that debunk this myth of a Reagan revolution. There's one, I think, that's even called the myth of the Reagan Revolution, something like that. And then,
it's a good title.
I forget that author's name. And then there's another one that was written by David Stockman, who's a really interesting guy, who was part of the Reagan administration. I want to say was Reagan's like budget guy or something like that, like his whatever it is, the Office of Budget or whatever that the president has. And basically, He makes the point as someone who had an inside look at it. And this other book, The Myth of the Reagan Revolution, is I think done more by like an historian looking at it from outside. But basically, in different ways, they make the same point that the dramatic change that Reagan represented was really more in terms of rhetoric than anything else. That, you know, that he didn't really, yeah, he, you know, cut some things here and there and, you know, shifted some stuff a little bit out of social programs into military spending or whatever like that. But as far as like, you know, really reversing even the Great Society, let alone the New Deal, there's very little you can point to in 8 years of Reagan. Like just to give an example, when Reagan was running for the presidency in 1980, he proposed doing away with several entire cabinet level departments. One of them was the Department of Education, and one of them was the Federal Department of Energy, I believe. And by the way, at the time, those two departments had only been in existence for a few years. I think they were both created in the 70s. I think they both came in under Carter, Reagan's immediate predecessor. So he was talking about doing away with the two at the time most recently created departments. And so he comes in, he's president for 8 years. Not only did he not do away with either of those departments, they got bigger budgets consistently the entire time he was president. So, you know, the idea that Reagan is, it's another case, sort of like what the media does with Trump, and I'm sure future historians will do with Trump, where they're going to act like this was like this fundamental overturning of the entire system, where in reality, in the case of both Reagan and Trump, the revolution is way more in just style and rhetoric than it is in actual policy or what the government's up to and all that.
Right. Yeah. And the interesting thing about Trump in that regard is that he still does represent the beginning of something new, I think, because he didn't govern very uniquely, but he was very demagogic in his rhetoric and
yeah,
style.
Yeah, he definitely was like a revolution in style, rhetoric, communication, all that.
And that, I think, is the beginning of – that's the key right there. That's the beginning of a realignment, is a revolution in style. That's what Jackson represented in a lot of ways. That sounds like that's what Wilson represented in a lot of ways.
Well, let me throw something else out there. Another thing I've been thinking of in terms of historical parallels to what we're talking about is that the comparison and contrast at the turn of the last century between progressives and populists – because
yes,
that to me is a very interesting thing to compare and contrast those two political movements and factions, and then also to look at, you know, parallels in our current situation, because to me what the American populace of the late 19th and early 20th century, what they represent is a potential new paradigm of politics. And then, you know, that started popping up as a political movement, really first in the 1880s, and then it reached its peak right around the turn of the century, and then starts to gradually fade in the first couple decades. And
actually, I have to throw out a bit of a correction. It actually began in the 1870s. That was really when it started to kick off. Yeah, yeah. And I'm only, you know, doing the well actually, because that was my first episode that I ever did for History Impossible was about the beginning of that movement and how, I mean, I crassly called it the original Donald Trump and talked about this populist in California named Dennis Kearney, who, if you read his rhetoric, it mirrors Trump's 2015, 2016 rhetoric almost exactly, just about Chinese people instead of Mexicans and Muslims. But the point is, and actually, this is good because I wanted to tie this in and I wanted to ask you what you thought of how populist backlashes, they seem to happen with relative regularity and they always seem to presage a political realignment. And what the historian Neil Ferguson pointed out, and I totally cribbed this from him and I gave him credit, but I cribbed this from him, that the populist backlash has usually about five distinct ingredients that are going on. And in the 1870s and arguably also in the 2010s, we had increasing inequality, a perception, at least, of rampant political corruption, a migration-immigration rise, an economic crisis, a major economic crisis, and then the rise of demagogues. And I think it's very hard to say that the populists of the 1870s and the populists of the 2010s and now the 2020s are really too dissimilar in that sense, because in terms of like the forces that are behind them or those factors rather. So I wonder what your take is on how what you were saying about populism being a sort of opposite of progressivism, how they fed off each other, how the populist backlash, if it did lead to the rise of the progressive realignment, if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I've actually got a lot to say on all this stuff.
Okay, cool.
A lot of this stuff are things I've been thinking about a lot lately, and also things I talk about, you know, not just on social media and in various podcast episodes, but these are things I actually bring up when I teach U.S. history too in my day job. I bring some of this stuff up, you know, of how I think about these things. And so one of the things I would bring up is that you've got in every political party or movement, there's always a split between the esoteric and the exoteric sides of that party or movement, right? There's always some amount of disconnect between what the rank and file members of that party or movement are all about, what their priorities are, what their issues are, and where they stand on them, and then the elite leadership of the party or movement, right? Now, And I think also, by the way, that this applies to all sorts of different organizations and institutions, not just political parties and things. I think you can find it in labor unions, in churches and religious organizations, etc. Basically, I think any human group, institution, movement that's more than a handful of people in number is going to start to develop this sort of iron law of oligarchy phenomenon where an elite emerges. And this, by the way, happens just as much in an organization that's nominally of a democratic ideology than one that's not. It doesn't really seem to matter. You'll always get this iron law of oligarchy emerging, and that there's always going to be some amount. The way I think about it is like the esoteric side of a party, the elite leaders, and then the exoteric side, which is what like the grassroots are about in terms of what they think the party should be all about. It's always a Venn diagram. There has to be some overlap. You can't have a party exist where the rank and file are in complete opposition to their own elites on everything, right? That would just not cohere. Whereas, but on the other hand, there's always some amount of non-overlap of their Venn diagram of what they believe the party should be doing and what their priorities are. And it varies from particular, you know, times and institutions, how much the Venn diagram is overlapping versus how much it's not, right? Now, when you look at a political party and there's a lot of overlap, in other words, there's not a huge amount of divergence between the esoteric and exoteric sides of the party, then populism is less likely to really be a force because the rank and file feels like their elites of their party really are on the same page as them, have the same priorities and stances and things, right? But when the Venn diagram starts to spread apart more and more, and there's an increasing disconnect between the party rank and file and the party elites, that's when populism will show up. And it can take various forms. It can take the form of an insurgency within an existing party. It can also take the form of a new party being started that draws members away from a party where there's dissatisfaction because of the increasing divergence of the esoteric and exoteric. So to me, for example, what Trump represented was, particularly over the George W. Bush years, the Republican Party elite got so far disconnected from regular, you know, blue and white collar Republican Party members that what Trump instinctively this is the one thing I think he's kind of an idiot savant at, because I think he's pretty dumb and ignorant in most things, but he's got this like brilliant like Rain Man magical talent to like figure out how to pander to people who are not being pandered to, people who are being neglected, you know, where the institutions and the establishment are pandering to everybody else, but to identify a large dissatisfied group and target them. Because what he did to get the nomination was he basically, of the Republican Party in 2016, he basically just went down right down the line of, what are all the issues that the rank and file of the party are really, really hyped up about that their leaders are absolutely refusing to address and represent them on, right? So basically, to me, what populism really represents is people feeling that they are not being heard and represented by the existing institutions. And it also I think it reveals when just in general, when an existing system has become, you know, things like government institutions, in my mind, they're always corrupt and dysfunctional, but there's degrees of that, right? There's degrees of that. There's a difference between a relatively functional thing that most people are satisfied with and a thing that's just a complete basket case of corruption and dysfunction. And I think populism also represents when institutions have become way more corrupt and dysfunctional than they used to be. And people sense that. And so, you know,
that's a perception of corruption right there. Yeah. And then when you have like the events like the financial crisis, you know, then, you know, that's just going to further push it along. I you know, honestly, when I think back on those like five ingredients that Neil Ferguson talked about, I do feel like maybe we should add natural disasters into there too. You know, a pandemic is just going to accelerate that sort of thing.
Potentially,
for example.
Yeah. I mean, any kind of a big problem that the existing system and establishment is like blatantly not fixing and maybe potentially even making worse, right? Can cause it to be discredited in the eyes of huge numbers of people.
And it's interesting because like you would think that the Great Depression would be something that would push a populist backlash into high gear, but a lot of the other stuff, the other ingredients were not present at that time. I'll defer to you on this, but the sense I get is that there wasn't really a sense of mass corruption within the government. People just didn't like Herbert Hoover and they blamed him for the depression, even though he had no control over that really. Like the impression I have though, is that there wasn't this sense that the government was hopelessly corrupt in the late 1920s, early 1930s.
Yeah, and I think especially once FDR came in, you know, and I'm not somebody who believes that the New Deal really was a good thing for the economy. I think the New Deal in various ways made the Depression worse. But what FDR, what he was very good at was communicating and giving people the sense that the New Deal is going to fix things, even if objectively it's not. But he was so persuasive that I think a lot of people during the 1930s in America – It let some steam out of the pot. Now, obviously, there still were people like Huey Long and other, you know, populist firebrands, right? So it's not like that kind of thing wasn't there. But I think FDR, just as a skillful politician and rhetorician, was able to kind of, you know.
I challenge anybody who, no matter how much one may like or dislike FDR as irrelevant, I challenge anyone to listen to those fireside chats and not feel a sense of warmth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just turn off your brain. Don't think about what he's saying. Just think about how he's communicating to you. And it's brilliant. It was, in some ways, it's the most brilliant form of propaganda ever to exist because it feels like Mr. Rogers. You know what I mean?
Well, he had the perfect communication skill and style for the dominant medium of that era. The dominant medium of that era was radio. He was great at radio. You know, he might not have done as well in an earlier or later era where radio was not the primary way a president would communicate with the people. But it was just like, you know, a luck of timing that right as radio is overwhelmingly dominating American media, here comes this guy who happens to be very good at that. Maybe there's an analogy or a comparison to be made in that Trump with Twitter.
Oh my God. It's like, it's one of those things when I try to explain to people, like I say to them, I'm like, I understand, because I have a lot of most of the people in my life or my friends, I should say, are they skew progressive. They skew blue. You know, I skew out there. I don't really. It's the point is that I tell them that Trump was, let's be honest, you know, rest in peace. It was one of the best tweeters of all time.
Yeah.
And not because what he said was good. That's the key there. I'm not advocating the stuff he said. The stuff he said was largely stupid, but he was good at it. He was good at being a stupid boomer on Twitter. Like, he was the best at it. I mean, Michael Malice brings up this a lot. A lot of people have brought this up, that the best tweet of all time is when he said, "I have nothing but love for all the losers and the haters. It's not their fault they were born fucked up." Yeah. Which is like, you can't not love that if you appreciate, you know, like, I don't know, irony, I guess, or meta irony or something. I don't know. It's just, it's so silly.
Well, it's an interesting comparison between him and FDR in terms of he essentially tweeted his way into the White House. FDR, you know, public speaking his way into the, you know, rhetoric his way into the White House. The difference though comes in that FDR was so much smarter of a politician just from a, you know, an effectiveness standpoint that,
and a human being, I'll say.
Yeah,
too,
I mean, he's obviously a much more intelligent, educated guy. Even though, you know, I think in many ways he's more evil than Trump. Did more damage to America, but FDR was able to, you know, rhetoric his way into the White House, but then continue to use that skill, in order to accomplish the things he wanted to accomplish. Like, he's one of the most effective presidents ever in terms of getting done things he wanted to get done. Whereas Trump, he had, and partly I think it's because FDR was much more knowledgeable and experienced about how the American system actually works. You know, he had been governor of New York. He had been, in the Wilson administration. He was Wilson's assistant secretary of the Navy during World War I. He had much more of an understanding of how Washington and the administrative apparatus works. And so he was able to leverage the skill that got him there, continue to leverage it for all those years to actually do stuff as president. Whereas Trump had no strategy, no plan. He had no understanding of how any of these institutions works. And so, yeah, you can, you know, be a world champion Twitter troll and get yourself elected. But he was never able to figure out how to then continue to use his Twitter skill to actually leverage it to get stuff done at the policy and institutional level. So basically, mm-hmm. he spent 4 years just throwing red meat to his base on Twitter, and his base were, you know, largely so deluded that they thought just because Trump continued to like own Twitter for those 4 years, that means he's winning. It's like, no, he's winning the Twitter sphere, but he did very little in terms of actually translating any of that into, you know, policy accomplishments.
And I think this transitions nicely into sort of trying to pretend that we exist maybe 20 years in the future, where we talk about the potential that there is indeed a realignment happening right now, that we're in the midst of. And that I do think that sort of the potential for any kind of accomplishment we can pin on Trump is that he was the spark, or possibly, again, the gasoline poured on the fire of the political realignment that may be happening right now. Because, as you say, he's throwing red meat to his base constantly. And just what he's doing is he's essentially priming them to just forget all the values and principles that they might have identified with being a Republican back in the day, you know, back in the Bush years, for example. He effectively, I mean, we see this playing out right now. The elephant in the room, as you effectively called it, we were talking last night, of the Ukrainian, the Russo-Ukrainian war right now. Trump, I would say, with the help of, you know, other demagogues like Tucker Carlson and so forth, has effectively turned the base Republican Party into the anti-war party, something that, as a millennial who was in high school when the war in Iraq kicked off, like that is bizarre. It's downright bizarre. I never thought I would see that happen just because of the time and place I, you know, was raised in. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And I'm not saying that, you know, conservatives haven't been anti-war. I mean, one of the best anti-war rhetoricians in the late 2000s was Ron Paul, you know, like the, you know, anyone who, you know, skews libertarian has been anti-war forever. So it's not that I associate being conservative with being pro-war. It's that I associate that coalition, the conservative coalition of being the pro-war party, because a Republican started, you know, the longest war we've ever been
right.
in. And it's just been really fascinating to see that script flip. Now, you know, you and I were talking about this too. You coined one of the greatest terms of all time, woke hawks.
I'm so proud of that one.
It's a good one. It's a good one. We got to get that trending. Hashtag woke hawk eyes. But the thing is that that's not that too weird. That's not that weird, at least when you look at the political establishment or the media establishment, that skews progressive, like openly, today in 2022, being super firebrand woke hawk about this war between Russia and Ukraine, because a lot of these people supported and or voted to invade Iraq. They were pro-war. They were just as pro-war as the guy who started it, essentially. And that sort of shows, again, I think, that there's something to the idea that it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican between 1912 and 2022. It's that, or rather 2016, maybe, it's that you are in the progressive milieu. You're in a milieu. We can call it progressive if we want. You can use whatever term you want. I think progressive is the most accurate, ideologically speaking, but I think that it's, and that's a tricky word, by the way. People get hung up on it because, and I get it, but the thing is, I think it's the best way to describe it. So it doesn't matter which side you're on within that milieu, you are all, you know, kind of voting the same way, supporting things the same way. And frankly, when you flip the script so fundamentally the way, you know, Trump and his ilk did, you're going to see some very significant changes that aren't going to make a lot of sense in the moment. And I think that's what's happening right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think, you know, if I'm right, that the last like big total paradigm shift really unfolded over 26 years, then, you know, we're in the middle or maybe still somewhat in the early phases of something that's going to play out for many more years to come before it's really finally, you know, the realignment is completed. And I think,
though, I do think the internet, though, might speed it up. There is always that to keep in
mind. Sure. Yeah. I mean, definitely things can unfold more quickly you know, just look at the collapse of the Soviet Empire as like something that real quick, you know, happened within just the space of a few years. But I wanted to call back to the turn of the last century populists versus progressives thing.
Right.
And make points and comparisons. So, you know, you probably know all this stuff, but just for the listeners who aren't familiar with this. So you have populism pops up on the American political scene as a new kind of force. You know, now I know as early as the 1870s really starts to become a bigger factor though, in the next couple of decades. And then progressivism pops up in academia around the same time, but progressivism doesn't show up in like actual politics for a little bit later. And so basically what happens is populism starts off in American politics a little bit earlier, and then it kind of crests and starts to fade. Progressivism pops up a little bit later and starts to peak later, but there's this overlap where populism and progressivism are both significant factors in American politics. There's this overlap period of, you know, really like the 1900s and the 1910s. And just for the listeners, as far as like comparing populism and progressivism, it's easy to look at them superficially and think they're very similar. And there was some overlap in terms of their ideas and even some of the personnel involved. But, and, you know, in broad brush strokes, both populism of back then and progressivism, they both wanted a larger, more powerful, more active U.S. government than existed at the time. So they're,
here's the thing, they still do
now. Good point. They're in agreement on they want a bigger, more powerful government than currently exists.
How much bigger can we get? Come on.
go full WEF totalitarian, I guess. But the populists and progressives did line up in the early 20th century on particular issues. Like, for example, both supported creating an income tax. That's one example. Also, there was a lot of overlap between them in that most populists and many, you know, probably a majority, but not all for sure. Most populists and probably a majority of progressives in the early 20th century favored alcohol prohibition. So there's overlap on that. So there's specific issues where you can see the populists and progressives aligned on that particular issue. But there's big differences overall, though, in terms of what their priorities were, who they were really representing, and what they thought this big government they wanted should do. So just in general, the populace tended to be much more likely to come from the more rural areas and small towns. And so because of that, the populist strongholds were the South and the interior West, whereas the progressives in the, say, turn of the last century, the progressives are much more numerous in the Northeast and the West Coast. Now, what does that sound like in terms of today's politics, right? Where are the Trump voter populists? They're in the interior West and in the South. Where are the progressives? Mm-hmm. They're in the Northeast and the West Coast. Like, it's literally the same thing. So to me, it's very much a case of history rhyming, right? The current progressive versus populist split. And then another parallel I'll point out is I think you can make a case, you know, if, as you were saying before, we see Trump as this, like, harbinger, not that he's going to complete the realignment, but that in a way he sort of gets the ball rolling on it. I think then you can make an argument that William Jennings Bryan fulfills the same role in the earlier populist versus progressive moment where, you know, his campaign in 1896 was seen as like a fundamentally different campaign in terms of his not just the content of his platform, but also in terms of how he did it. It was kind of a new controversial thing that he personally can't. He was the first presidential candidate to really personally campaign heavily. William McKinley did what was actually the norm at the time, which was to stay home and basically have your surrogates go out on your behalf. You know, the thing before McKinley, up till McKinley, was you know, that you almost, if you were running for president in America, you would almost pretend like you weren't personally involved, you know, like you weren't even personally trying to do it. You just have your surrogates go campaign. And then, you know, maybe like McKinley did, give the occasional speech to the press from your front porch. William Jennings Bryan traveled personally all over the country by train, giving speeches to the people constantly. And that was seen as like a completely radical new way to run for presidency. And the forces of the establishment at the time were terrified of Brian. It's hard for us to wrap our heads around today, but like whether it's the economic establishment, the JP Morgan type people, or whether it's the more establishment politicians, they were terrified of Brian in a way that is somewhat reminiscent to the way the modern establishment was terrified of Trump. And ultimately, right. Brian was never able to get himself elected president despite trying three times. Trump did get himself elected president, but then found himself completely, you know, unable to do any of what he wanted to do. So both Trump and Brian ultimately made a giant impact on the system, created all kinds of new, you know, precedents and things, terrified the establishment, but ultimately failed to actually make any lasting impact other than in terms of style and all that.
And I was going to say, if I remember right, Teddy Roosevelt took that method, the Brian method, and perfected it, basically, right? Because he was a personal campaigner, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, he adopted the populist, you know, tactics in a lot of ways.
So we could have a new TR in the post, as it were. We don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So in other words, like an establishment liberal, but who adopts...
Or a Republican. It could be a Republican. That's the other thing that we should keep in mind. It could be a Republican who does it. I doubt it, but...
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. But I mean, liberal in the sense of represents the centrist, neocon, neo-lib consensus establishment perspective, but that dresses it up in populist-sounding rhetoric and in populist methods.
Yes.
So, you know, somebody who is going to govern like Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell, but who has a style that's more Trumpian.
So what that could be then, if we're speculating, that would be an example of really just a realignment of style, but no meaningful ideological realignment. It would be if the realignment that we're speculating could happen was essentially a bust and just doesn't actually occur.
Yeah, yeah.
If that happens.
Although also it could be that it doesn't work this time. The way, you know, the progressives who – at the end of the day, I think the progressives were the more establishment force than the populists at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the populists generally did represent more average people. Now, you know, it's just rural people for the most part. It wasn't really average people in the cities they were representing, but that the populists really were in good faith trying to represent the wishes of their constituents. Whereas the progressives have this much more elitist, paternalist concept of representation, which again goes back to Woodrow Wilson's ideas, which is that the people get to vote, but only after we tell them what they ought to vote for. And also in cases where the people don't vote the way they're told, we'll figure out ways to basically override the popular will. So
it begs the question of like what would an actual realignment look like if it was successful. And you know what? Now that I think about it, it probably is too early to tell, because like you said, last time this happened, it was like a 26, possibly 36 year, you know, project. It's hard to say. Like if it is happening though, I do have my reservations about it, as I think we all should, because as you said, or, you know, as we were talking about, populists and progressives are peas in a pod when it comes to wanting more stronger government and thus a curtailment of individualism, essentially. It's the first time I should have mentioned this earlier, but I just remembered the first time I noticed something was happening, at least that I believed something was happening, was when I heard both people hard on the left and hard on the right, both bemoaning the role and importance of individualism in our society. And that's when I was like, okay, if they can agree on that, then something's different. Like, and it's because progressives and populists tend to agree that individualism is suspect. And that seems to be the trend for me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, they tend to be collectivistic ideologies, just of different, you know, different flavors and emphases and everything like that. And it just occurred to me, you know, in real time here, kind of thinking out loud, that, you know, I mentioned towards the beginning of our conversation my kind of idea of having multiple cycles going on different, you know, time spans that occasionally line up and coincide where a bunch of them are realigning it at roughly the same time. And there's another even bigger picture cycle that I hadn't thought to add to that list until just now, which is the cycle of rise, decline, and fall of empires. And that,
of course,
that also is the United States in the middle of a significant imperial decline, potentially even fall. And is that a giant realignment that throws an extra level of potential volatility, right? In the same way that the collapse and fall of the Soviet Union did for those parts of the world, where, you know, you had all these other giant changes occurring cyclically, and then boom, in this particular case, it lines up with the actual decline and fall of the American Empire. And I want to share with you a quote I pulled up because I have it saved on my computer. This is from Carol Quigley's famous book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which probably many of my listeners for sure have probably heard of. It's kind of notorious in certain circles. And this is near the beginning of the book. He lays out, as a lot of historians in the 19th and early 20th century did, had these like ideas of societies or civilizations going through kind of identifiable stages, right? Where there's like a rise, and there's a sort of like a peak period, and then there's a period of decline and whatever like that. And he talks about it, and I'm trying to remember, I think he gives like four stages of societies going through like growth and then eventually stagnation and decay and all that. And this quote was so interesting. I was rereading a little bit of Tragedy and Hope recently, and this quote, which I had previously like kind of just passed over, given recent years' events, this quote jumped out at me in a way it never did before when I'd read Tragedy and Hope previously. So in this quote, he's talking about the shift in a civilization from what he calls the age of expansion to the age of conflict. And the age of conflict is where the institutions start to break down, all that sort of thing. And listen to what he says as far as like what you see. And keep in mind, too, he was writing this in 1966, which is arguably right around the time that the American system starts to decline from an age of expansion into an age of conflict. So he was at like the very end of the age of expansion. So anyway, he writes this quote. It is this decline in the rate of expansion of a civilization which marks its passage from the age of expansion to the age of conflict. This latter is the most complex, most interesting. Oh, actually, you know what? I just realized since we're on Zoom, I can screen share this quote with you.
Cool.
Yeah, okay. I've got it with a little picture of Carol Quigley because I sometimes put this up, you know, project it to my students. So anyway, it is this decline in the rate of expansion of a civilization which marks its passage from the age of expansion to the age of conflict. This latter, the age of conflict, is the most complex, most interesting, and most critical of all the periods in the life cycle of a civilization. It is marked by four chief characteristics. Now listen to these things and then you tell me if these things can be found in current American events. Four chief characteristics march the transition to the age of conflict. Back to Quigley. A, it is a period of declining rate of expansion. B, it is a period of growing tensions and class conflicts. C, it is a period of increasingly frequent and increasingly violent imperialist wars. And D, it is a period of growing irrationality, pessimism, superstitions, and otherworldliness. All of these phenomena appear in the core area of a civilization before they appear in the more peripheral portions of that society. So in other words, why does it seem to those of us who live in red areas, why the people who live in the major, you know, blue metropolises of the Northeast and the West Coast and DC, why do they seem to just have lost their minds? Whereas, you know, us in the red areas are supposed to be the superstitious ones and the, you know, crazy religious ones and whatever, right? And yet he says it's in the core first that you see growing irrationality, pessimism, superstitions, and otherworldliness. And only later do those things sort of spread out to the peripheral areas. So anyway,
that's definitely, that's stark. I'll say that. I mean, it's funny because you just made me think the core of America is considered to be the, you know, the red core, if you will, tends to be seen as superstitious and so forth. And yet I recently just heard of this and I don't have a Jamie like Joe Rogan does, so I can't fact check this right now. But I recently read something by the writer Batya Unger Sargon, who recently wrote a book that I've been planning to read called Bad News, How Woke Media is Destroying Democracy. And she's definitely of the more populist bent, of these days, but from the left, which, by the way, that's a whole other realm of the populist backlash we currently find ourselves in. We can't underrate Bernie Sanders and his role in all this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he seems to have completely been co-opted and emasculated and whatever. Yeah. So he as an individual is pretty much done as far as relevance.
Right.
But yeah.
Right.
Someone else.
He played a part is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah.
That's
but somebody else tapping into the same sort of thing that he did, who's more consistent and principled and not as easily co-opted by the establishment, would be another wild card, you know.
Never say never, you know. I mean, I think as long as Trump is in the game, which he still is, despite being an old ass fat man, he's going to be the elephant in the room no matter what people do. So I don't think we're going to see anything meaningful come from the Democrats. They won't let a Bernie Sanders happen right now is what I'm saying. They will just do a repeat of what they did in 2015, 2016, where they threw him under the bus within the DNC. But my point, though, about Batya Unger Sargon's writing was that she was talking about how quietly and nobody seeming to notice, evangelical churches across the South, the Bible Belt, are becoming more inclusive to LGBT people. Yeah. And I can't speak to that. Like I said, I don't live there and I haven't fact checked it. But the point is, let's assume that's true. And maybe you can speak to this. I mean, I know you're like me. You're not religious, but maybe you know people or something. But the what that says to me is that the socially progressive project of being pro-LGBT back in an anti, you know, bigoted Republicans who are meanwhile, you know, fucking male prostitutes in the Minneapolis bathroom. But regardless, that battle, I mean, it wasn't just the passage of the Supreme Court case legalizing gay marriage. Culturally, if the Bible Belt is becoming more inclusive of LGBT people, the war is won. There's nothing left to do.
Yeah.
Because that's what you did. You won. And the fact that if that's happening and nobody's celebrating that and yet are still acting like they are raging revolutionaries, like fighting against the system when they are the system, like that says to me, that says a lot of things. In a word, I would call it out of touch decadence. Well, in three words, but
well,
yeah.
Well, the really, current super woke people, their whole ideology is very Maoist in a lot of ways. And one of the things that I think is very Maoist about their ideology is they seem to believe in this idea of just perpetual revolution. And so they can never take a victory lap and take a bow and also never, you know, acknowledge that they've convinced their former enemies to change their mind about something. So yeah, it's like as soon as the gay marriage thing went through and, you know, pretty quickly, it seems like most, you know, Republicans or whatever, were like, okay, I guess that's the thing now. It's not, you know, not a big deal to them anymore. Surprisingly quickly, the woke progressives didn't even take a moment to be like, hey, you know, congratulations, all you Alabama people who now are more or less okay with this. Good for you. And let's all like take a breather and just, you know, kind of.
And be friends and show that we're all on the same page with each other.
Instead, the next day they were like, if you don't believe that, you know, there's 27 genders, you're a Nazi. You know, it's like.
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't understand.
Even acknowledging that, for example, when Obama ran for president the first time in 2008, he was opposed to gay marriage.
Or the famous case of Hillary Clinton not coming out as being in favor of gay marriage until 2013.
Right.
Like it really does speak to like the reality that, you know, he had his issues, but something that Andrew Breitbart coined, that politics is downstream from culture. I don't know if that's always been true, but it's definitely true now. And I think this thing we're talking about really shows it. And I that's why I kind of understand the impulse for, especially now, conservatives, namely Republicans, to just engage in culture war issues, because it's easier to win those when your opposition is pretending like they're still fighting a perpetual revolution, like you're saying, which is funny, by the way, that like they do see themselves in a way as Maoist. I mean, I have seen, you know, people making those overt comparisons about themselves in a positive way when they don't realize that the only reason Mao started the perpetual revolution that was the Cultural Revolution was to regain the power that he lost after the Great Leap Forward. It was just a power play on his part. doesn't make it any less nefarious. Don't get me wrong. It's just that it's really funny that they think that it was sincere. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, you know, from my own perspective, you know, cause I live in North Florida, which is the more southern part of Florida.
Sure.
The county I live in is relatively cosmopolitan and has a lot of northern transplants. So it's a little bit unusual mm-hmm. for this area, but you know, I'm surrounded by counties, including the county that I work in, that are very, you know, deeply red, in the political sense, and that, you know, lots of people are evangelical or whatever. And yeah, I've noticed the same thing where it basically to me is at the end of the day, it's a generational switch where the mm-hmm. older generation of evangelicals were much more, you know, dug in, dead set against ever being nice to gay people or whatever. And the younger generation, they're still, you know, devoutly evangelical Christian or whatever, but, and they might still, you know, I think still would dig in their heels on certain things like abortion and a few other
sure.
things.
Sure. That's a thing that's never moved.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating thing. I just want to throw that out there. The abortion question, it's still like 50-50 and it hasn't changed. And I don't think it's going to, but to
yeah,
continue
yeah,
your point,
that's
sorry.
That's its own like special unique issue in so many ways. But it seems like on a lot of things, particularly just on kind of just in general, you know, tolerating gay people and not overtly
sure.
protesting them getting married or whatever. There's just a generational thing where, you know, a 20-year-old evangelical today is just a completely different type of person than a 20-year-old evangelical was 30 years ago.
And that shift is something that makes me happy. Like, as I said, like I, you know, that should be seen as a victory. I mean, I've grown up with gay people my whole life. So obviously I'm a, you know, that's my perspective coming into this. Like I see it as self-evidently true that they deserve, you know, the same amount of dignity as anybody else and so forth. And I like the idea. I like the liberalization in that particular, with this particular issue, but with other things too, I suppose, in some ways, the liberalization of the conservative faction of American politics. But there is something that concerns me, and I wrote a piece in my Substack about it that, you know, I think you read it, right? I don't remember if you read it or not. The one where I said the post-liberal order is probably not your friend. And that's because I was trying to lump together this sort of populist backlash specifically from the right. And there's a wild cast of characters there, especially in this realm called the post-left. That is an area of Twitter that is so fun to follow because it's just so interesting. But it's all of it is very reactionary, very anti-progressive. So, you know, one point for them there. But the thing is, the more I listened to a lot of them and read a lot of them, especially from the folks over at Claremont, the Claremont Institute, the more I realized that all I'm seeing in terms of prescriptions on how to live up to these, you know, values and standards and traditions and so forth that they say they stand for, like their prescriptions is just saying, this is should be what we focus on. And it's just always couched in very vague terms that just sound like a statement of first principles ad nauseum. And that's fine. But the thing is, I started to break down what this post-liberal populist order is wanting in this potential for realignment. If they are if they're the drivers of the realignment, what they're pushing for is just garden variety social conservatism is what it sounds like to me. And if they really want to push it to the point where the state plays a role, then you're talking about something closer to theocracy at that point. And that's what disturbs me about the populist right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you on being very uncomfortable with that particular strain or wing, you know, cause there's obviously some different wings, you know, there's the more kind of like libertarian or classically liberal types and, you know, who I tend to be more sympathetic with overall.
Well, the most contempt I see directed at libertarians these days isn't from Bernie Sanders types. I mean, I know a few people who hate libertarians and anarcho-capitalists. Sorry. I mean, I'm more aligned with you than I am with them in a lot of ways, but I just like the contempt I see directed at libertarians and anarcho-capitalists seems to be coming mostly from the dissident and populist right. Again, it's they want the big state power just like the progressives do. They just have different priorities.
Yeah.
And that's been very interesting to see that level of contempt directed in that direction. It's I mean, that's fine because, you know, the Republicans weren't doing very well with that kind of politics. So maybe they need to embrace something new. I understand that, but I just don't. It strikes me as like the only alternative being offered within the conservative space, within that part of the conservative space. Cause again, there's no way to say, is this going to be the driving force forever? I don't know if it is, but if it is, we're talking about something, you know, akin to something that the Judge Adrian Vermeule wants, which is Catholic integralism, stuff like that.
Yeah. People who seem to really want to actually create something that looks like The Handmaid's Tale, or that looks like a Christian House of Saud or a Christian Taliban situation, yeah. Or something like this, you know?
Yeah.
And the people that want to undo the entire Enlightenment and scientific revolution, that want to go back to something pre that, or even fully medieval. And it's like, don't get me wrong. I've got all kinds of criticisms of aspects of the Enlightenment and scientific revolution, more so the Enlightenment. Sure. But the idea of like, we don't like some aspects of the Enlightenment legacy, therefore let's throw the entire thing out in some, you know, probably yeah. ludicrous, impossible attempt to turn back the clock 1,000 sure. years. It's like, I'm sorry, you're throwing out a lot of baby with that bathwater, as far as throwing out the entire Enlightenment top to bottom, because I don't object to every single idea or person who was part of the Enlightenment. Like, some of them really made some really good points, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and for how racist he was, Voltaire had some great points. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of – yeah. And I think that's – you know, I don't think that this strain of populism on the right – that goes that far, you know, I mean, you're getting into neo-reactionary Mencius Molebug territory there. I don't think those have a chance in hell of actually being implemented in any meaningful way necessarily. But again, when a realignment happens, you should never say never. That's all I'm saying, yeah, I guess, well, is that it's something to keep in mind.
And let me throw another variable into the mix too, which is, you know, and this ties into the whole idea of potential imperial decline and collapse of the American system overall. Is the possibility that the United States will break up into various pieces, either, you know, completely, in the sense of like breaking up into a whole bunch of little independent sovereignties, or even if it happens, like there still is some sort of central government, but it becomes way more decentralized. That's what I'm hoping for, honestly. That's another possibility. Yeah. And in a situation like that, where there's either just total breakup or vast amounts of devolution and decentralization, it's possible, and, you know, this might actually be, if it could be done in a relatively orderly and peaceful fashion, this might actually be one of the best solutions to our current problems, which is that different groups, like, for example, the neo-reactionaries, if they were to concentrate geographically in one area, right. They could do it on a small scale, right? They're never going to take over the entire U.S. government. There's no way they're going to do that. And I think they'd be the first to admit that they're not going to be able to do that. And that's why they're not even, you know, really trying that tactic. But the possibility for them to like take over a particular little area and set up what they want to set up. And the same thing too with some of the, you know, more militant wokies and whatever, that in that situation, you know, you might end up with like the West Coast being a woke theocracy, you know.
We just got a house. I don't want to hear that.
Yeah, and people like you are going to have to flee as refugees, as many people already are to Texas or Florida or whatever like that.
Yeah.
But there is this, and COVID really stomped on the gas pedal of the trend of people moving within the country for cultural and ideological reasons, right? There's, you know, the clearest cut example of this is the Free State Project trying to get libertarians to move to New Hampshire. But there's...
How is that going, by the way? I've told people about that because a lot of people don't know about that. And I think it's fascinating because I think it was when you're interviewing the guy who started it or somebody involved in it. Yeah, it was a while back, but I remember he made the comparison to what Bernie Sanders did and his ilk back in the 70s, I believe, or 60s, whenever it was. And they completely changed the political demographics of Vermont, because Vermont was like a hard red state, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My understanding is it was a very conservative, you know, state right there in the heart of New England, because it's a very lightly populated rural state. And so then you had, you know, the movement that Bernie Sanders was a part of, which basically were a bunch of New York City socialists who came in, and because Vermont was so lightly populated, it didn't take that many of those people moving in to radically change the politics of the state. And, you know, that wasn't as formally organized as the Free State Project, but it's the same basic idea. And
right.
Yeah, Vermont is such an interesting place. I've only been there once briefly, but
same. Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful place. And what's really fascinating to me about Vermont is it's the only state I can think of that is simultaneously very rural and very blue. I don't think there's any other state in America that fits that description.
I mean, technically, you could say California is kind of like that. We have a lot of agriculture here, but it's not blue there. It's very red.
But the vast majority of the California population are concentrated in the larger metro areas, right? So
yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and the main like exports from California are culture and tech. So, you know, it's doesn't really matter that it's rural, it has rural in it, but it's significant is all I'm saying. Yeah. It's interesting.
And, you know, I would say that Texas and Florida fall into the same category where all three of those states, California, Texas, and Florida have vast areas that are lightly populated, that are rural, that are either agricultural or even wilderness. And so there's huge stretches of all three of those states. You drive through it, you're like, this is a rural state. But of course, they also, all three states have giant metro areas. And, you know, the bulk of the population of each of those states is concentrated in, you know, a relatively small number of major metro areas and their suburbs. Whereas with a state like Vermont, that's really not the case. Like it's just little towns and agricultural areas and mountains.
Has the Free State Project been progressing?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like,
for lack of a better term.
I'm friends with some people that are involved in that. I've actually spoken at a couple of different events in New Hampshire, Free State events. So right. Yeah, I'm a little bit plugged into those folks.
And it's doing better than it, I mean, I shouldn't say better because it was doing badly, but here's
my perception, and I haven't been up there since pre-COVID, but my perception is there's two things happening at once. One is good for the Free State Project and one is not. And that is, I think COVID did give a boost of people moving to New Hampshire. I think it's one of the top places people are moving to who are more libertarian, along with Florida and Texas.
Interesting.
And Tennessee. Those are kind of the big four that I hear about. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nashville's a big one.
Florida,
yeah.
Texas, yeah. Tennessee, and New Hampshire. So I think COVID gave a boost to people fleeing to New Hampshire. But the problem is COVID also gave a boost to people fleeing to New Hampshire from places like New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts who are not libertarian, who they're moving because blue state policies have wrecked where they're living, but because they're so ideologically committed to the progressive ideology, their brain can't make the connection and go, why is it that if I live in New York City, for example, everything has gone to shit and I want to move to New Hampshire where everything seems a lot better? They don't make the connection. It's because of the politics that I supported and voted for. And so the
Free Staters just got to kill them with kindness. They got to kill them with kindness.
You know, keep those
saying.
People out, build a wall. Yeah.
Or that too. Yeah. Well, I mean, this gets to the thing that the idea of fragmentation that we were talking about. I have my skepticisms about individual states forming. Like I agree with the notion that, like, in principle, that if a group of people want to establish their own state, especially when we exist in such a sort of chaotic time like this, I agree that if they want to establish their own state with their own values, that seems reasonable and they shouldn't be interfered with. And yes, I realize I sound like a Confederate, but what I'm saying is that there are people who just refuse. There are so many people. I don't know if I'd say the majority, but there are so many people that would just refuse to ever admit that they have anything in common with someone they see as their enemy or their opponent that they see as their enemy. And the reason why I am skeptical of the notion of, you know, micro states within the overall United States is maybe it's just because I've been reading too much about Yugoslavia, but it just the alarm bells start going off in my head. And I start thinking, like, well, what if the neo-reactionary state needs some Lebensraum, if you will? What if the, you know, the Wokistani state needs, you know, or wants to expand its territory? Territorial expansion becomes a very real risk when you start to have things like that. So that's why I have my reservations about that. And I'm more inclined towards the idea of greater decentralization and decoupling from the federal government, because then, like, you still have the system intact ostensibly, but it more matches the reality of our lived experience, which is, you know, atomized through the internet, essentially.
Yeah, well, I mean, when countries break up and there's secession and whatever, it can be ugly and violent, but it can also be, you know, fairly orderly and peaceful and all that. It really just depends on the circumstances.
What's the example of that?
There's several.
Yeah, I was gonna say I could think of a few, but I don't remember which ones they were. Was it the Czech Republic and Slovakia?
Yeah,
was that relatively?
That's one.
Orderly?
My understanding is that was completely, you know, just peaceful, like referendums and stuff like that. And you know, as far as I know, there was no violence involved in that. You know, there was.
Nothing like the Balkans.
I mean, there was at most
like
some heated debate. You know, some politicians wanted to keep it together, others didn't. But and another one, and I forget the exact like time period this happened, but when Norway seceded from Sweden, because Norway for a long time was part of the Swedish Empire.
I forgot about that.
And I forget. I want to say it was the 19th century, maybe, but I could be off on that. But yeah, when Norway broke away from Sweden, again, my understanding is it was all purely through the political process, totally nonviolent. Nobody attacked each other. And as far as I know, Norway and Sweden, yeah, they have a little bit of rivalry with each other, but like, it's like the same as like the rivalry that a Floridian and a Georgian might have in terms of like, they're not going to fight it out other than maybe if they get drunk watching the University of Florida play the University of Georgia football team. Like that's as far as it goes.
The one thing that worries me though, is then I start thinking, and I'm half joking, that I'm thinking like, oh man, but Minnesota Vikings fans versus Packers fans versus Bears fans, that shit gets violent. So I don't know. That's what I mean is like, I see more. Basically, I think how I look at it is that the one thing we should never accept, and I don't know, I'm going to sound like a total draconian statist here after just coming off and saying, look, in principle, it's okay for people to try to establish their own states. I can't imagine anything good coming out of states being established based on religion or race. And if we allow for that, I almost guarantee, and this is just my cynicism, pessimism, really, I can almost guarantee conflicts will happen at that point if we let states separate by religion or race, because that's what happened in Yugoslavia in so many words.
Yeah, well, I think what increases the likelihood of a breakup of a bigger nation into smaller pieces, the likelihood of it being relatively orderly and peaceful, one is, of course, having the political elites of the bigger system being okay, right, with it breaking up. You know,
that's the big thing.
Do you have a Lincoln who's willing to deploy a Lincoln who's willing to deploy unlimited violence to prevent the breakup versus a Gorbachev who ultimately, you know, lets it go peacefully. So that's one factor.
Right.
The other factor in determining how peaceful and orderly secession is how neatly are the different groups grouped together? Because to me, when you look at Yugoslavia, the biggest problem there, you know, aside from the centuries of hatred and whatever, is simply the fact that because that was part of a multi-ethnic empire for so long, the people were mixed together in this very haphazard sort of a way. So it wasn't like you could draw really neat, clear lines and say, oh, all the Serbs are in this one area. Let's draw a line around that. All the Croats are in this one area. Instead, everybody's mixed up. And so then they end up fighting each other because they're sorting themselves out. And like, if you've got a town that's half one group and half the other group, and both of them want their people to be the only people in charge of that town, it's a zero sum game. Whereas basically what I'm saying is it would be good if before any attempt, if political breakup is going to be a thing that the US goes through in the near future, it would be best if the self-segregation of people that actually want to live together with each other took place before the political partition happened. You know, so if people voluntarily group together based on these are people I actually want to live with and share a society and a government with, and
share
and only at that
and whatnot,
point when that process has largely sorted itself out and there's not these messy situations, right, where there's like, you know, these dark blue islands in the middle of red states and vice versa, that, you know, you have to have the self-segregation taking place peacefully and voluntarily for however many years it takes for that to largely sort itself out, because otherwise you end up with something like Yugoslavia breaking up, or another case where it was pretty ugly and lots of people died and mostly it's overlooked in the West is the partition of India and Pakistan, because, you know, the majority in what became Pakistan were Muslim and the majority in what became India were Hindu, but there also were a lot of Hindus in Pakistan and vice versa. And so when partition happened, you had people on the wrong side of the line that, you know, there was violence, there was, you know, people as refugees flooding back and forth and really messy. Whereas, you know, if I, And I don't know in that situation how you could possibly have done anything to prevent that. But if somehow the British on their way out were like, okay, anybody, we're gonna leave and have partition in 10 years, letting you know. So if you're a Hindu in the Northwest, please try to move, and vice versa. If you're a Muslim in the rest of the country, you know, if there had been some way they could have done that and allowed that to play out in a peaceful, orderly way, people to move to the other side of the line and then say, boom, all right, now it's partition. Well, now you no longer, you know, they may still eventually over time, India and Pakistan may very well still have, you know, developed rivalry just as two nations next door to each other often do, but you wouldn't have had that nasty, ugly phase of partition happening the way it did. And furthermore,
right,
probably at least some of the continuing hostility of India and Pakistan at each other ultimately goes back to partition and how much violence and bloodshed like that. I think that's a big part of why India and Pakistan still hate each other is because they're both still angry and bitter because both sides suffered greatly during the chaos and violence of partition.
You could also add the story of Palestine into this pretty neatly.
That's a messy one.
Though that gets a little – yeah, and it gets a little more complicated. You know, my favorite political writer, Christopher Hitchens, was notorious throughout his entire career, even when he became a bit of a war hawk himself, of being vehemently opposed to any kind of partition because he saw the India-Pakistan partition, the Israel-Palestine partition, and just all partitions as being – evidence of evil imperialism, essentially. And I don't think he was wrong. Though with Palestine and Israel, it gets a little more complicated because of historical circumstances involving what was happening to the Jews everywhere, especially in Russia and Eastern Europe, necessitating them to get the hell out of Dodge. That just morally complicates it, but also because a lot of the dissent that was very populist, funny enough, from folks like Haji Amin al-Husseini, who I covered in my ongoing series about the so-called Muslim Nazis that I am going back to, listeners. I haven't forgotten about it. But yeah, like it was very much driven by ethnic hatred, by anti-Semitism, ironically, because they're all Semitic people, but anti-Jewish hatred. And I think when that took over, that basically rendered the role of the British not irrelevant, but less relevant than, say, for example, India and Pakistan, I would think. Though I do think the British could have definitely done a lot more to ease the transition. But again, I'm contradicting myself constantly because there's this other aspect of it. They did submit a plan. I believe it was a white paper that was very favorable to the Arabs to the point where like the Zionists were very angry about this. I think it was in the late 30s. There's so many white papers and proposals that were put out back then. But the one they put out, though, it was very favorable to the Arabs, very disfavorable to the Jews, and the Arabs still rejected it. So when I read about that, it was because of Haji Amin al-Husseini. So when I read that, I was like, well, that's your fault now because you couldn't compromise. So that's your fault. But anyway, that is to say partition it can be very ugly, especially if it's not, like you're saying, pre-planned. And that's why I think because I've just seen so many examples of it not working and have just, you know, because of my own biases, tuned out the instances of it working, that I tend to be skeptical of the idea of a United States partition.
Well, I think it is more likely to be messier also. And when you're looking at both Israel-Palestine situation as well as the India Pakistan situation. In both cases, these were places that were ruled by an outside alien empire in India for quite a long time, in Palestine for a while too.
Sure.
And so there's another factor that made those, you know, partitions particularly nasty, which is in both those cases, the British had for many years been deliberately, and I would refer listeners to my episode I did a while back on divide and conquer, divide and rule.
Do it, guys. It's great.
Yeah, it's one of the episodes of the past couple of years that I've made that I'm the most proud of. And this was all the way back in summer of 2020, like right in the middle of George Floyd riots and everything. And basically, you know, the British were deliberately not that divisions in India didn't already exist between, you know, Hindus and Muslims and other different groups or whatever, but the British deliberately amped those up while they were running.
They leaned into it.
They did.
Yeah, they helped emphasize the untouchable cast notions and things like that. Like, they very much made things worse.
Yeah, they very much were doing divide and conquer strategies in order to be able to rule this giant, you know, continent with a relatively light footprint of English, you know, civil servants and bureaucrats and soldiers. And so again, then they look to leave, and it's sort of like what I was saying before, where when a leader of a democracy, of a modern democracy during wartime, propagandizes his population, makes them bloodthirsty against the enemy, then when it's time to end the war, you can't end the war with like a limited victory and be magnanimous to your enemy. You've got to go for total victory, even if that causes negative long-term consequences, because you can't flip the switch on your population that you now have frothing at the mouth. And it's the same deal.
Yeah.
The British are stoking divisions in India for, you know, over a century, and then they want to leave, and they're like, oh no, you know, we can't put the genie in the back in the bottle. We can't just snap our fingers and make all the divisions that we helped to amp up for 150 years suddenly, you know, everybody forgets about those things.
It's that Eric Andre Hannibal Buress meme.
Oh, I don't know that
You know, where he – oh, OK. Well, it's where Eric Andre like shoots Hannibal Buress and then turns around and looks at the camera. And it's always framed as like, you know, in this case, it'd be Britain shooting or rather causing all this division in India.
OK, and then I know the meme you're talking about. And
then they leave, and it's like, why would the Indians and Pakistanis do this? Yeah. No, I think that's very true. And
let me just bring up a potentially disturbing possibility in the case of the United States. Could you argue that the establishment, meaning both the dominant, you know, federal government institutions as well as the corporate media and all that, have they been pursuing a divide and rule strategy, and wokeism is one of their main tools for doing this? And I think clearly they have. And so that makes it so.
I think it's at the very least, it's completely reasonable hypothesis.
Yeah.
And that's me being as like devil's advocate as possible.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And so again, you know, if the federal government were to say, all right, tomorrow we're disestablishing ourselves and the states are just going to be republics now, you know, in states where there's a lot of mixture of red and blue, so to speak, to oversimplify a little bit, but you know, in states where there's 50-50 of red and blue people, you know, not just politically, but culturally, or where there's things like, you know, the blue island of Austin in the middle of red Texas and things like that, might there be more potential for violence there, in part as a legacy of the fact that the establishment has been amping up divisions and really,
right,
you know, doing divide and rule so heavily?
You can see that this is what makes me cynical about it, because it probably goes back to I'm going to say it might have started with Bush, but definitely under Obama and then definitely under Trump. The opposition, those who dissented against the person who was elected, increasingly started to act like and talk like they were subjects of an imperial master.
Yeah.
Like the rhetoric was shockingly similar to things like that. And what's so fucked up about that, frankly, is we are all under the same imperial master, in the sense that, you know, yes, like the "not my president" bumper sticker is BS. It's just BS. Every president is your president, even if you didn't vote for them. It's what we're stuck with. And what disturbs me is that I think you're right. I think that there is an element of divide and rule going on that I think the media is only complicit in as much as it allows it to keep the lights on, because the media is not doing well economically, I should say, the mainstream media. So they're just trying to do everything they can to keep people engaged, and to keep people engaged is to keep them at each other's throats, figuratively speaking. And I think the one thing that disturbs me so much about the idea of because like I only see two possibilities, I guess, when I boil it down. Either A, you have the federal government finally just saying screw it and washing its hands and decentralizing the states and saying, like you're saying, you're all republics now. We're all in this together, but you're all republics now. And then that just causes this massive upheaval of social unrest and violence within the more contested states. Like my home state of Minnesota, Minneapolis is this little tiny blue island in the midst of red. Like that, there's going to be problems there. There's probably going to be problems here in California and maybe even in Florida. I don't know. I mean, maybe less so. But the point is that I think that decentralization, even though it's ideal, it wouldn't be conducted smartly. And that's what's worrisome to me. But then on the other hand, you have self-directed attempts to create your own republic outside of the United States. Secession, in other words. Texas has tried it. California had it on its ballot a couple years back. And when that happens, then you're just incentivizing a crackdown from the federal government, essentially, because I can't imagine any president, Trump, Biden, whoever, tolerating the idea of a state seceding largely because they hate the leadership in Washington. I don't see toleration of that whatsoever, because there's I don't know if you're a Trekkie like I am. I'm a big Trek nerd, and there's a line from Star Trek Deep Space Nine where there's this the bad guy. His name is Gul Dukat. He's a Cardassian, and he says in one episode, while his forces are occupying the space station that's the center of the episode, he says to his subordinate or to somebody he works with, he said, "It is not victory to just, you can't just beat an enemy. For it to be a victory, you have to let the enemy know why they were wrong to oppose you in the first place." And that's really how I see it turning out if people try to self-direct their secession, is the federal government's going to just have that little monologue in the back of its head, whether it knows it or not, and just going to crack down on it and keep everybody as submitted as possible once they reconquer the territory that tried to secede. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm going to have to call it quits fairly soon, because I've got a few errands I've got to run, because it's almost 4 p.m. here at my time on a Sunday afternoon. But I did want to raise one more thing, and it's potentially a bright spot in all of this in terms of a realignment that potentially could lead in a direction that might be one of our best case scenarios. And that is, I don't know how much lately you've been following Tulsi Gabbard. She seems to have really gotten red-pilled on some things in the last few months. I think because of just watching the Biden administration in action and how much of a disaster everything has been, she has basically publicly said that she regrets having endorsed Biden and supported him. She's frequently using words like the power elite to describe, you know, what I would also use as a synonym for the establishment and things like that. You know, this thing that's not just the government, it's, you know, the dominant politicians, it's the deep state, it's the big corporations, it's Hollywood, it's all, you know, kind of one thing. And she's been, I always, you know, have mixed feelings about her, but she's been sounding anyway, you know, when I'm not saying I necessarily 100% fully trust her, but she's been sounding really good lately on Twitter. And I don't know if you've if you had a chance to, she spoke at CPAC. And
I know that blew my mind. I just found that out right before we got on this call.
And you know what? I had been meaning to do it ever since she gave the speech. But earlier today, partly in preparation for this conversation, I went and listened to her speech. I watched her speech on YouTube, and her CPAC speech, you know, I definitely don't agree with everything she said, but on most things, big picture, she was really good. Like, she was good on free speech. She was good on you know, opposing the COVID regime. She was good on defending the right of parents to have a say in their child's education content. I mean, she was really good on you know, praising things like the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. Unlike Joe Biden, she actually correctly said the Declaration of Independence intro, right? She didn't go, "Yeah, all men and women created equal, you know the thing." You know, she actually said,
"Hey, Jack, you know the thing."
she actually was coherent. And I mean, she's usually a very good speaker and very good on TV, you know. But anyway, I wonder if she might not, and maybe, you know, I should know better, and I'm not saying that I am, like, putting all of my hope and trust or whatever in her or anything like that, but I'm saying that there's at least the possibility, if she is honest about, you know, where her beliefs are at right now, and if she continues in that direction, and, you know, that she might be able to bring together some of the best aspects and factions of the kind of counter-establishment milieu, right, and bring them together in a over positive things, like, you know, free speech and free thought and those sorts of things, rather than bringing them together in terms of, like, let's create a theocracy or something like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think, yeah, I like this positive note that we can definitely close on, because it will make me feel less despairing at just, you know, the lack of possibilities. Because, like, what I've been noticing with Tulsi is that, especially with this Ukraine thing, I was at first thinking that she was kind of flip-flopping a little bit, but what I'm sort of sensing in what she's doing, and I think this is conscious, because this is not an insult, this is a compliment. I think she's trying to figure out her political identity in a new, unique way while still trying to remain positive and trying to bring as many people together as possible, like you're saying. And I think that that honestly could mean that the next Teddy Roosevelt figure who capitalizes on the beginning of a realignment could be someone like Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah, only in my book, at least, she, unless she's completely faking what she believes in right now, she would be far better than Teddy Roosevelt in almost every way. But yeah, I mean, this is the one bright spot. And yeah, definitely, I would say to you and to anybody listening, go watch her CPAC speech on YouTube. It's really good. It's really good.
I have to watch it. I just saw the article about it. And of course, it was Daily Beast that talked about it. So they were just snarky the whole way through. But I'll watch it and just keep my mind open, obviously, because I think anybody who, again, it's like the issue that I have with populism in general, which, by the way, I don't see it as an ideology. I see it as a tool. And that's why I don't think it has much sustainability in the long term. And I think Tulsi Gabbard is someone who recognizes that and utilizes populism as a tool for, hopefully, if she's sincere, the sake of, you know, bridging gaps and creating unity. Now, who will accept that? Definitely not, you know, her former party, but, you know, maybe one day. I don't know. I anybody that comes at this with positivity and a lack of doomsaying, like what we've been doing for the last like 2.5 hours or so, anybody who comes at this with positivity and ideas, I don't really care at this point what party they're in. I've never voted for a Republican. I know you don't vote. And, you know, I was, you know, I'm continuing on that. I'm going down that path myself at this point. But like if someone like, you know, her comes along and can provide us with a vision, something real and not just fakery, like a lot of presidents, pretty much all my presidents in my lifetime have been doing, then I think, you know, there's reason to not be super pessimistic about everything.
Yeah. And one more, I actually might, for the first time in many years, vote this year in order to cast a ballot to reelect Ron DeSantis as governor here. Mm. And now I'll say this, I think DeSantis has been, again, I don't agree with him on everything and whatever, but for this particular time period and what the issues have been, he's been about as good of a governor as you can find. And
it's the opposite of my situation, as you know.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think he's going to get reelected by a wide margin, actually, even though he got elected the first time by a very narrow margin. But I think he's going to get reelected for a variety of reasons, by hands down, you know, maybe even a landslide. I actually am not as positive on him being president. I think he would be a worse president than he has been a governor for a variety of reasons, a lot of it to do with foreign policy. For president, as of right now, I would actually prefer Tulsi Gabbard to Ron DeSantis. I'd rather have DeSantis stay as governor of Florida. But, you know, he's also been – he has surprised me. I didn't think much of him when he got elected governor. He struck me as a typical Republican.
Just typical blue-pilled Republican.
Yeah, very kind of standard, you know. And then when the COVID stuff hit – is when he really showed a genuine independence.
He took a stand. I mean, that was, I mean, it's funny when it comes to COVID and stuff, I tend to just hold my tongue on things because I just, you know, it's just, I don't feel like I have a firm enough grasp on stuff like that, on like what good policy is necessarily. But as it became increasingly obvious what bad policy was, it was kind of hard to deny that he was doing what I saw to be at least reasonable stuff.
Yeah, he was basically following the strategy laid out in the Great Barrington Declaration, and he was even consulting with a lot of the people who wrote the Great Barrington. Like that's the thing about what he did in terms of resisting the COVID policies of most other states. He wasn't just doing it like in a Trumpian way where he's just doing it randomly or instinctively or whatever. He actually was doing what you would want someone to do, which was consulting with a variety of experts. And, you know, supposedly, like, he was reading, you know, the alternative medical journal articles, questioning the lockdown strategies. You know, he's apparently a very intelligent and well-read guy who, you know, not your typical politician. So he's really impressed me over the last couple of years. But again, I'm not as big on him for president. I would support him for president if he publicly expressed a sea change in foreign policy views. You know,
right.
if he's like, you know, I've changed my mind about, because as far as I know, he's still a standard Republican on foreign policy. But if he came out
like a neocon, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, not quite as bad as a full neocon, but like a standard kind of middle of the road Republican on foreign policy. If he came out and basically, you know, said, I've changed my mind, I now am much more in line with like a Rand Paul or somebody like that, then I'd say, okay, maybe this is our best option for now for a president.
And that would be evidence of a realignment.
Yeah.
That's a good spot to end right there, I think.
Absolutely. No,
by the way, I just want to say, though, maybe I'll keep this in, I don't know. But I have started to think, because the more I was learning about Jackson, the more I was thinking, we really should bring back duels. Specifically, yes, for elected officials. Daniele Bolelli, our buddy, is, you know, he's fully on board with that, but on a global scale. So yeah. I say we should do it. But anyway, that was awesome, man. We got 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Not bad. It's Joe Rogan length.
Yeah. And my battery didn't die. I kept looking at it because it was at one bar and it's still going. So
yeah, mine didn't either.